Another Way to Die from Disturbed. It is our top song for the second week in a row. That's it for us today. I'm Nikki Six.
I'm Carrie Casey.
On the Sideshow Countdown, we'll see you next week where we count down the biggest songs in rock, and I'll handpick some songs just for you, freaks. See ya.
The Sideshow is now over. Go ahead, stick a golden fork in it. We're done.
Now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Jolene, off for the night. She's taking in a music festival. Been there for about a week or so, man. She's going to be rocked out. You know, I don't know. I used to love to go to music festivals. They're the big one these days, am I correct? Is there anyone bigger than Bonnaroo in Tennessee? Bonnaroo has got all top headliners of rock and a lot of indie bands as well. And yet when friends of mine go there, they tell me two things happen. Either, well, sometimes it's both. Either it's in the middle 90s, so you're outside camping, you're just crowded in with everybody, or there's torrential rains, or both. Well, I can't handle it. How about you? Well, welcome to Detroit's most progressive political talk show committed to peace and social and economic justice. If you'd like to call us, 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. If you'd like to email me, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Usually, Jolene fields the email, so it's going to be even harder with me doing it all. I got to push all the buttons and everything. Stephanie is here with me. So when you dial 313-298-WRIF, you will reach her. So it's she and me. She and I. Me and her. What's it go? I got to change. What? What do you think I'm going to say? I got to change screens. Oh, come on. Come on. Or I won't even be able to get you on the air. How the hell you do this? I don't know. We'll have to figure that one out. In any event, during the Bush regime, I call it the regime because, you know, usually you reserve that to illegitimate political formations, people that have seized power illegitimately. And in my estimation, Bush stole both elections. Wow. What's everybody want to talk about? I have no idea. Usually you expect this huge rave, which I may, in fact, let loose. So while Steph, do this. Will you, if you can hear me, just go down the row there. Just say, night call, hold on, and, you know, then people won't think we're not answering. Anyway, my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com, has a lot of supporting information from what I'm going to be talking about. And we're on Facebook. Facebook friends always wanted. It's, what is it, facebook.com/nightcall. And also, Stephanie's going to be putting together our podcast, and it should be ready by noon tomorrow, noon on Monday. So please join us. What am I looking for? Oh, yeah, I'm trying to figure out how the hell to, there's a way. Ah, there we go. Okay. Are we on the air? You know, I always do that. if we had, like, a staff of 20, like most talk shows have, and everybody thinks, oh, man, how do these talk show hosts know so much? Well, they don't know squat. I know more than them. Here's the deal. As soon as someone calls in and... I don't even know what the hell this means. But someone says they want to talk about credit scoring rally on Thursday. So immediately the producer finds that out and puts it up on a screen. So the talk show host almost knows what sounds like he knows what he's talking about. Anyways, big news and good news that the federal court has rejected California's Proposition 8, which bans gay men and women marrying. And it's one of those, the gay agenda's taking us over fear kind of deals. But a federal judge in San Francisco struck down California's voter-approved ban on same-sex marriage, saying it discriminates against gay men and gay women. On the face of it, doesn't it do that? Well, yeah, and you can't do that. It handed supporters of such unions at least a temporary victory in a legal battle that probably will get to the Supreme Court. Wednesday's decision is just the latest chapter and was expected to be a long battle over the ban. Proposition 8 passed in 2008 with 52% of the vote. And it says, indeed, while striking down Proposition 8, the decision will not immediately lead to any new same-sex marriages being performed in Chicago, in California. And the chief judge of the Federal District Court in San Francisco, Vaughn R. Walker, was a Ronald Reagan appointee. But I guess the guy can read the Constitution, right? Judge Walker wrote, Proposition 8 cannot withstand any level of scrutiny under the Equal Protection Clause. Now, you know, these conservatives who oppose gay marriages, for what reason? They weren't even able to explain to this judge. They had two witnesses in there, and one guy actually said he couldn't really say how it would harm heterosexual marriages. And no one has ever been able to call this show and say how it would harm traditional marriages as well. Or let me put it another way, traditional marriages being heterosexual marriages. And he writes, Judge Walker writes, excluding same-sex couples from marriage is simply not rationally related to a legitimate state interest. Hello, religious, you could have religious guys saying, well, it's against our religion and we don't want to sanctify it with our religious ceremony. Okay. In fact, some people have said there ought to be two separate, essentially ceremonies. One, because the state regulates all marriages. All states regulate all marriages. They're not regulated by religious orders or denominations or anything like that. When a priest or a rabbi or an imam or anybody, a minister marries someone, marries you if you got married or married your folks or something like that, he was acting as an agent of the political state. So for the political state to allow discrimination in who can get married, says Judge Walker, it just doesn't meet the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, the 14th Amendment. But let me read that again. Excluding same-sex couples from marriage is simply not rationally related to a legitimate state interest. You can say you don't like that. You find it morally reprehensible. You can say you find it against your religion. Whatever. You can say whatever you want. It's your opinion. If you say any of that, I think you're kind of stupid, to tell you the truth. Oh, I guess I'm not supposed to be that mean. I would disagree with you strongly. Strike that, Your Honor, please, the first part of it. But in any event, it would be up to you, because the defendants in this suit who supported this Proposition 8 banning gay marriage could not come up with a legitimate state interest. They said, well, it erodes traditional marriage. And the judge said, how? And he could hear the crickets, right? Couldn't tell how. Well, supporters of Proposition 8 said the decision defied the will of the people of California. It won by 52% of the vote, and that now is the conservative mantra that one man overruled 7 million people. Now, California has a population of 36.5 million people, so it's not like this enormous majority. But in any event, what if it was 30 million people that voted to withhold legal rights, withhold equal protection under the law from a particular category of people? What if they had a referendum in California that said marriage privilege could not be extended to mixed-race couples? That a black man and a white woman or a white man and a black woman couldn't marry? Well, people would say, that's ridiculous. Well, we know that there were laws in the United States that forbid what they call miscegenation, the mixing of the races, up until 1967. There were laws in 1967, and they weren't repealed by the state. Finally, guess who? The Supreme Court said, this is patently unconstitutional to forbid people based on race marrying. What if they said Jews cannot marry? What if the majority of people said Jews cannot marry or Muslims couldn't marry? So what? How many people voted in a referendum like that? That's why. And here again, I mean, that's why these conservatives are so full of it. Because when the Constitution they think works for, they don't ever follow the Constitution. They cite it like some sort of religious icon. But when you come down to it, they don't pay any attention. attention to it whatsoever. One of their big calls was, they keep saying, the United States is not a democracy, it's a representative republic. Or it's just a republic. Yeah, and it has three branches of government with equal power, although there's been a massive power grab by the presidency, particularly under Bush, and Obama hasn't done much to reverse that. But you have a situation where that there are, remember this from civics class? Checks and balances. So that if the states have laws saying there can be segregation, or that blacks and whites can't marry, or 100 other things, the Supreme Court, used to be seven men, right? Now it's, 4-3 in terms of gender. They can say, sorry, that does not meet constitutional muster. And boom, seven guys may, or now 4-3, may overturn the popular will, because the popular will often is tyrannical, which is exactly why the Founding Fathers had that in their Constitution. I mean, they invented this out of thin air, right? People say it was the Iroquois Confederation that they got a lot of the ideas from. Yeah, but that kind of formal juridical stuff came from England. I mean, so there was some precedent for it. Wednesday's decision to declare Proposition 8 unconstitutional, banning gay marriage, applied only to California and not to dozens of other states that have either constitutional bans or other prohibitions against same-sex marriage, nor does it affect federal law. The Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, D-O-M-A, Defense of Marriage Act, right? So they're defending marriage by denying marriage to, I don't know, several million people. Make any sense? Not to me. Let's see. Still, the very existence of federal court ruling recognizing same-sex marriage in California, the nation's most populous state, set off cheers of "we won" from crowds assembled in front of the courthouse in San Francisco. And these were joyous crowds, men and women celebrating, mostly gay, sometimes gay allies. I would consider myself a gay ally, if you will, and my wife as well, to get my hetero creds in there, right? Why would I have to do that? But in any event, they were joyous because these were people say, I'm beginning to be recognized as a full human being. And if you don't have any of those qualities that relegate you to second-class status, and that's almost everybody other than us white males, right? I don't think you can understand it. I only can understand this sort of intellectually through reading and listening to people. But to be told you are so much less than a human being that you can't even marry, that that the state does not recognize a union of love, that's pretty insulting. So just as the miscegenation laws forbidding blacks and whites to marry, as were present in our country for so many years, or the segregation laws, which were declared unconstitutional, even though a vast majority of people in the states that were affected by it supported them, right? So the majority of people just doesn't matter. The Constitution matters to protect people. Absolutely. Evening rallies and celebrations were planned in dozens of cities across the state and several across the nation. Let's see. During the trial, which ended in June, plaintiffs offered evidence from experts on marriage, sociology, and political science, and emotional testimony from the two couples who had brought the case. Proponents for Proposition 8, that's the people who wanted to ban gay marriage, offered a much more straightforward defense of the measure, saying that same-sex marriage damaged traditional marriage as an institution. And the problem was, and it doesn't say it here, they couldn't come up with any single reason why. I mean, I wonder if there's any of you. Could any of you come up with why that my marriage or your marriage or your parents' marriage would be harmed because gays can get married? It doesn't make a bit of sense. And they couldn't come up with anything. And that marriage was historically rooted in the need to foster procreation. Well, if anybody getting married in their 50s, what does that say? Or what about people that that don't have reproductive capacity? They said this was fundamental to the existence and survival of the human race. You can tell what nutballs these people are that put forth this argument. That's what we need. More people on the planet, right? Let's get some more people. Let's ban anybody that that can't reproduce from marrying. In fact, why don't we outlaw birth control? Oh, yeah. Some people want to do that, don't they? Anyway. Judge Walker seems skeptical of those claims. Tradition alone, however, he wrote, cannot form the rational basis for law. because segregation was lawful. Slavery was lawful. It was even in the Constitution. How the decision might play politically was also unclear. In 2004, same-sex marriage was seen as a wedge issue that helped draw conservatives to the polls. And what it did, and this is what these Republicans and conservatives want to do, they want to play on people's prejudices, because they're all about the economics. They think you're a pack of fools if you're voting for the average Republican. They're in the pay of the multi-billionaires, the oligarchy, the plutocracy that runs this country, totally undemocratic. But they know if you say, hey, we represent the interests of the ultra-rich, and we don't care that you're absolutely getting screwed under this system, that the tens of millions of you can't find jobs, and bad news, you're probably never going to get one again, that this country is going to wind up with a political and social and economic structure like Mexico or Guatemala. If they tell you that, well, you're going to say, wait a minute, I'm not going to vote for those people. So they have to disguise it behind all this stuff like gay sex and, you know, 100 other things, immigration, all that stuff. You know, mosques, they're building mosques, you know, what? In fact, that plays into this, exactly. To his credit, Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger said he supported the ruling. Let's see, Kristen M. Perry, one of the plaintiffs. Now, who among you is going to, I don't know what you'd say, refute this or not accept this decision? Kristen M. Perry, one of the plaintiffs, said, the decision says that we are Americans, too. We, too, should be treated equally. Our family is just as loving, just as real, and just as valid as anyone else's. If you want to spit on that, I don't even know what to say. Please don't call. I don't think I can handle it. I know Jillian couldn't. Jillian's not here. Argentina legalized gay marriage in a historic vote a week or so ago. Oh, this is July 15th, yeah. All right, just hang on if you're on the phone. Jeremy and Butch and AJ and John. Okay, I wanted to get somebody else on soon. All right, there's going to be a mosque, in fact, a big Muslim center built in New York, and it's going to be two blocks from Ground Zero, from 9/11. So the Republicans are whipping up this enormous froth, this frenzy about this is going to be an insult to the people that died on 9/11. And behind it, of course, this Republican, Daniel Senor. Is that how you say his name? He was one of those high-ranking Bush officials that was in the coalition in Iraq, one of the guys that screwed up everything. And you think, after somebody that made such egregious mistakes, that they would just disappear from the stage of history. But they never do. They just keep coming back. These criminals from, like, the Reagan administration and the Bush 1 administration and the kids administration just keep, reappearing in some role to make things worse, always. And let's see, it's going to be a 13-story complex. It's located two blocks north of the World Trade Center. Now, here you go. National Republican leaders like Newt Gingrich and, of course, Sarah Palin assailed the proposal, calling it offensive. Those opposed to the project have argued that building a Muslim community center so close to the site where radical Muslims killed about 2,750 people is as much a political statement as a religious gesture, and have demanded that developers find a different location. Well, folks, if you listen to this program for any length of time, you know I'm no friend of organized religion. But what about the Oklahoma City federal building? What if someone's going to say, we're going to build a Christian Christian church right near the Oklahoma City federal building? What would you think a bunch of Muslims said, hey, these people represent a religion filled with killers? What about those people that assassinate, abortion doctors? And you say, well, wait a minute. If we build a Christian church near where an abortion provider was assassinated because of these extremist Christians, this will be a monument to terror. And what about, again, these frauds, these conservatives who say that are so steeped in property rights? These people own this site, wherever the hell it is, two blocks close to 9/11 or wherever. Whatever happened with their idea for that? And, you know, they want, yeah, they're talking about repealing parts of the 14th Amendment. But the important part, both of this controversy, the thing about the mosque and also about gay rights, it says, no state shall make or enforce any law. This is the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of the citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And if you're not allowing someone to dispose of their property in a legal manner, the way the law allows, you're depriving them of that. So there's no way. I mean, you might say, hey, you know, that's probably not the best place for you to have thought to put your mosque, but what the hell? They've got the rights. And the Jewish American mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, says this has got to happen. He says, we would betray our values if we were to treat Muslims differently than anyone else. But here also, in the 14th Amendment, nor can the state or the federal government deny to any person within his jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. That the state, the federal government, cannot deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Is there any way that anyone listening could square that with a ban on gay marriage? Someone wants to marry another man, right? Someone wants to marry another woman, and you're going to deprive them of equal protection of under the law. Come on. Conservatives are such frauds. Well, let's see. There's also, again, riled up by the Republicans all over the country, there are these big oppositions to people wanting to build mosques. And you could say, okay, 9/11, Twin Tower site, special place in the iconography of our history now, something that'll be remembered forever, and everyone will remember where they were, if you're old enough, where they were on that day, on September 11, 2001. So, you know, You could say, well, maybe it's not the best judgment on their part, but there's no way in the world that they could be not denied the right to do that. Now, there's other battles all over the country in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Republican, gee, what a surprise, candidates have denounced plans for a large Muslim center proposed near a subdivision. Hundreds of protesters have turned out for a march and a county meeting. Let's see. In late June in Temecula, California, members of a local Tea Party group took dogs and picket signs to Friday prayers at a mosque that is seeking to build a new worship center on a vacant lot nearby. So they brought dogs. Maybe these are the same people that would bring big slices of ham to a synagogue. Well, they could do the same to a mosque. In other words, people that claim they're not racist purposely bring dogs that strike deep fear into the heart of many Muslims. Not all. I don't want to get any stereotypes. And who consider dogs unclean. Yet they bring those purposely as an insult to purveyors of a particular religion. In Sheboygan, Wisconsin, a few Christian ministers led a noisy fight against a Muslim group that sought permission to open a mosque in a former health food store bought by a Muslim doctor. Again, you know, this is private property, but they don't care. Let's see. Opponents have said their problem is with Islam itself. They quote passages from the Quran. And hey, everybody ever read the Bible, the Old Testament? Pretty murderous document. I mean, slavery, genocide, all this stuff, you know, allows for all of it. And they argue that even the most Americanized Muslim secretly wants to replace the Constitution with Islamic Sharia law. I mean, this is so insane. I know any number of Muslims, and that's not what they want to do. Feeding the resistance is a growing cottage industry. There's always people making money off this. Right-wing authors and bloggers are invited to speak at rallies, sell their books, and testify in churches. Their message is that Islam is inherently violent and incompatible with America. Again, the history of Christianity is, well, it's been a bloody sword. Its role in the conquest of the Americas, supporting colonialism, its insane religious wars in Europe and all that. Come on. Let's see. But they have not gone unanswered. In each community, interfaith groups led by Protestant ministers, Catholic priests, rabbis and clergy, and members of other faiths have defended the mosque. Often they have been slower to organize than their mosque opponents, but thankfully their numbers have usually been larger. And this just goes on. Oh, yeah. This mosque in Temecula, California, the owner of the 25 or the lot, Mahmoud Harmush, who is the imam, the priest, said that Muslim families that contributed to the local food bank sent truckloads of supplies to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina and participated in music nights and Thanksgiving events with the local interfaith council. We do all these activities, he says, and nobody notices. Now that we have to build our center, everybody jumps to make it an issue. Well, the only thing I would disagree with here, that it is not everybody. It is these right-wing whack jobs who are bound and determined to make a bad situation even worse. We're in bad straits right now, folks. And rather than thinking of ways we can come together, these people are always trying to split us apart. They don't call these issues wedge issues for nothing. And here, get this. Recently, a small group of activists became alarmed about the mosque. This is the one, which one is this? This is the one, yeah, in Temecula, California. Recently, a small group of activists became alarmed about the mosque. Diana Serafin, a grandmother who lost her job in tech support this year, said she reached out to others she knew from attending Tea Party events and anti-immigration rallies. First off, is there any way we get the New York Times never to, or anyone to use that phrase, reach out? And then anyway, as a mother and grandmother, she says, I worry. I learned that in 20 years, with the rate of birth population, we'll be overtaken by Islam. You know how they reproduce, like rabbits. Oh, no, I guess they don't, do they? Well, anyway, their goal is to get people in Congress and the Supreme Court and to see that Sharia is implemented. Well, I mean, these people are off the edge. But here is the most pathetic part of it all. Here's the most pathetic part of it all, besides the fact that that this is so insulting to so many people, that the stupidity of this woman. Here's the language, which is important. Diana Serafin, a grandmother who lost her job in tech support this year. So what the hell is she doing? Does she join some group that's trying to deal with the economic situation, with the unfairness of the way this economic system is put together, the fact that the middle class is being destroyed, that more and more jobs are going overseas, even when we see what that's done to it, that billionaires are getting more and more billions, that the bailed out companies are getting one another more and more bonus, giving each other more and more bonuses? She's going to try to stop. She's going to take her energies, her emotional energies, her political activity, and try to stop a mosque. And this is exactly what the Republicans want. Because if you start looking at the real issues, man, well, here's the way you reach out, as they say, to the real issues. 50 years ago, almost, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was in Detroit. He was sitting in the UAW headquarters on East Jefferson in Detroit, and he was writing a speech about words that would stir the America that he faced, the segregated America of the South, and the inability of African Americans to vote. And you know what he came up with. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out. He gave that first in Detroit on August 28, 1963. He marched down Woodward Avenue with 125,000 people with him, mostly African American, but a lot of Euro Americans as well, including then UAW President Walter P. Reuther. Well, this is being replicated now. The new UAW president, Bob King, says it's time for people to lead the change for working families and all America, because the politicians aren't doing it. They're letting us sink. The rich are getting richer. We're going down the drain faster. Well, maybe you're not. Maybe your neighbor's not, but someone you know is. Someone in your neighborhood is. Foreclosures are rising. He says, time for bold policies that transform this society and focus on everyday citizens. Policies that result in jobs for all people in our society, investment in the future of our children by building factories, rebuilding roads, and reducing the economic hardship for millions of Americans. It's time to rebuild America with jobs, justice, and peace. And contrast that to these crazoids on the right. What do they have? In fact, they hope to regain the House and regain the Senate. And you know what their strategy is for proposing alternatives to Barack Obama, his tepid approach to all the ills of this country? Say nothing. Don't put forth anything. People get, you know, disillusioned with Barack Obama. I am. And it'll all fall into our hands. And then we'll... What are they going to do? Well, they won't let the taxes on the tax cuts for the rich expire. That's for sure. But there's going to be another march. Martin Luther King Jr., Walter Reuther from the UAW, 125,000 people marched down Woodward Avenue on August 28, 1963. Almost 50 years later. That is going to happen again on March 28th, a Saturday, 10:30 a.m. People are going to assemble at the UAW Ford National Program Center at 151 West Jefferson in Detroit. And that must be, what, that's right downtown. That's the old, what the hell is it, the Veterans Memorial Building. And the demands are rebuild America by enacting industrial and trade policies. Can we have tariffs back, please? Get rid of the World Trade Organization. Get rid of NAFTA, all that stuff. All the stuff that the Republicans have supported and the Democrats signed on to, like Bill Clinton. Enforce the law regarding workers' rights, civil rights, industrial regulation, the creation of fair and just educational, economic, and health policies. And end the ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and redirect the war budget to rebuilding America. This is costing us hundreds of billions of dollars. It'll be over $2 trillion that we've wasted on these war industries and just wasted completely from these damn wars. The lives of Iraqis, the lives of Afghans. And who else in the country is saying this in an organized manner? Those right-wingers sure aren't. Those conservatives who love the war because they never fight in any. And the Democratic Party isn't. That leaves it to who? Bob King, the president of the UAW, is saying it leaves it up to us. And he and others are going to lead a march on August 28th at downtown Detroit. And if you were 18 or 25 or 45 or 55 in 1963, you had two choices. You could stay home and watch The Price is Right, or you could have marched with that. You could have been part of history. You could have said to the next generations of people that, yes, I was there in one of the big marches in American history where Martin Luther King first gave his I Have a Dream speech. Same thing here. You can stay home and watch television and hope that the people that control our future are going to do what will help us. Well, if you haven't seen by now that they have no intention of doing that, I just don't know what to say. All of this information is on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, peterwerbe.com. And, hey, my apologies to Jeremy and Butch and AJ and Mike and Jeremy. We will be right back to you.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werbe and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Did you know that life insurance rates are near record lows? If you don't have coverage, listen to this. AccuQuote can help save you up to 70% on a term life policy that's right for you. Pick up the phone and call AccuQuote at 800-654-2075. AccuQuote has helped hundreds of thousands of people save a fortune on their life insurance. Here's how. AccuQuote monitors hundreds of top-rated life insurance products so you can get the lowest rates. For example, a healthy 40-year-old can buy $500,000 of 10-year level term for less than $21 a month. Rates for women are even lower. A short 5-minute 5-minute call is all it takes. Call AccuQuote for a free life insurance quote at 800-654-2075. Rates, policy forms, and availability vary by state. Find out how much you can save on life insurance. Call AccuQuote for your free quote. 800-654-2075. That's 800-654-2075. Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents lime scale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187. If you want a new computer but think you can't get credit, think again. Just call Tronics Country right now. No matter what your credit status is, now you can own a brand new desktop or laptop computer. Your approval is guaranteed as long as you have an active checking account and can afford small weekly payments. With Tronics Country, there's no credit check. You will not be turned down. Call right now and order your new computer. You'll also get a free color printer and a free digital camera. Just call 800-990-2258. But that's not all. Call right now and you'll also get a free 22-inch high-definition TV with your paid purchase. You heard right. A free TV with your new computer. All you need is an active checking account and your approval is guaranteed. Don't wait. Call Tronics Country right now. Call 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258.
Detroit's Rock Station 101. The Riff.
Want to fight childhood asthma? Then fight it with a scrub brush and a hot soapy towel. Even in the neatest and tidiest homes, if there's so much as a crumb to eat or a drop to drink, household pests like bugs and mice will do all that they can to get it. Creepy crawlies like bugs and mice are unpleasant enough as it is, but they're more than just a nuisance for kids with asthma because they can actually trigger an asthma attack. So, give them a whole lot of nothing. Sweep up crumbs, wipe down tables, scrub dishes before they pile up in the sink, and store leftovers in plastic bags or bowls. Don't leave them so much as one tidbit or nibble, and you can stop a childhood asthma attack before it starts. Discover other simple ways to prevent an asthma attack. Call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS or visit noattacks.org, because no child should feel like a fish out of water. A public service message brought to you by the U.S. EPA, the Ad Council, and this station.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to our second segment. Jalene is off this Sunday, off at a music festival. 313-298-9743. Oh, I haven't even checked our email. She usually does that. So we're talking about everything about the ban on gay marriage being overturned, which is very good, and this opposition to mosques, which is very bad. In fact, I was in the city recently in the United States that's 60% Muslim. I wonder, I'll ask people whether they know what that is. And if you know, don't call to say, because, it might make, and it's not Dearborn either. All right, let's take some calls. Here is AJ. AJ, welcome. You're our first caller. You're on the air.
Peter, how are you? This is AJ O'Neill from AJ's Cafe in Ferndale.
Oh, wonderful establishment up on 9 Mile Road, an independent coffee house. Hey,
yeah,
what a concept.
One of the rare ones remaining.
Yeah.
Well, we're having a town hall rally and Senate roll call this Thursday. And as I listen to you, I can't help but see the parallels in everything you've been talking about. House Bill 5634, it's already passed the House, and it needs to pass the Senate. Basically, what that will do, it will ban the insurance industry and their record-breaking profits from being able to use your credit score and your level of education to set your insurance premiums on no-fault auto insurance. It's just such a scam.
Well, it sounds like it, and I've seen I've seen the abuses of that before. Let me say that I know you've done so many things at AJ's on Nine Mile Road in Ferndale, and this seems pretty technical. How'd you get tipped into this?
Well, it's like a lot of things, it found me. I got a great friend in Butch Hollowell. He is the chief consumer advocate for the state of Michigan for the insurance division. He also plays open mic. He likes to come, get away. And right after the Michigan Supreme Court ruled in favor of the insurance industry, basically saying the governor didn't have the authority to issue a ban on this practice, that it had to be done through law, he had a gig at my place that night. So I walked up, consoled him. I said, hey, Butch, we can have a rally here if you'd like. And he said, well, maybe we can, because the only thing that'll trump the Supreme Court's decision is to get the Senate to pass this law that's already passed in a bipartisan effort in the House. We needed to get passed. So I said, Butch, let's not only have a rally, let's have a roll call. Let's call every senator and put them to the fire, hold them accountable. So I faxed every senator a letter on Friday instructing them to call from 5 o'clock p.m. to whenever they wanted on Thursday, August 12th, and we're going to have an actual homemade tote board, and we're hopefully a lot of people come out and rally, and as the senators call in and give their support, we're just going to clear and cheer and clap and get this thing done. Get it done for the state of Michigan. It's bad for the economy. It's bad for the auto industry, and it's bad for all of us that are hurting with this economy. And it's giving tons more money to these rich right-wing.
Just to what we were talking about. Well, I'm looking up at our board here, and there's a Butch from Lansing on hold. Could it be?
That's my buddy, Butch.
Well, good. All right, give us the time and dates and everything like that. I'll testify. You got great coffee and pastries and sandwiches and soup. On 9 Mile Road, just west of Woodward, on the north side of the street. It's AJ's. And give us the details.
Well, it starts at 5 o'clock on Thursday, August 12th. Goes till roughly 8 o'clock when we segue right into an open jam, because music and activism go hand in hand, as you well know. And we want as many people to come there to support, because other than the elections and us getting out there and assembling and letting people know that we hired these senators and we can fire them, this is the only way we can do it. So Thursday, 5 o'clock.
Well, let me get on there. I'll try to get up there. It's,
I would love it.
And let me get to Butch, okay?
Fantastic. Good talking to you, Peter. I mean, I was fascinating listening.
All right. Thank you very much. And Butch Hollowell, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Good. We've met once or twice.
We have. And if I could just kind of go back, I love what President King, by the way, is doing and his new emphasis with the UAW. After Dr. King gave that speech, there was an album made of the speech, and my grandmother bought it for me.
Wow.
And I used to sit in the dining room, and I memorized that speech, and I used to get into speech contests, and I started winning them, and that's how I became a lawyer. And it got me interested in public speaking, and so I was very much riveted to what you were saying, and very much support what the new direction is with President King. I think it's extremely important. and you were talking about, you know, there's just no excuse for people not to get up and get out and do something. I'll be there at that march for sure. I think you probably know I used to be the general counsel at the NAACP.
Right. But let me just bring people up to speed, because sometimes people join us and they might think, ooh, what's he talking about? We're talking about a march called by the new UAW president, Bob King. And this is a march essentially for social, economic justice and peace. It's going to happen on August 28th, a Saturday coming up at 10:30 a.m. People meeting at the UAW. W. Ford National Program Center, right? And I'm right, isn't that at the foot of Woodward?
Really right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're exactly right. And like I said, I think it's really important to do that. And just now what I do is I'm the representative for consumers in Lansing on auto insurance. And just what AJ was talking about, it's all the same spirit. In terms of social justice here, with this credit scoring epidemic that's going on, the insurance companies have, once again started kicking people while they're down. You probably know that, you know, in his final days, Dr. King had shifted from a purely civil rights conversation to a anti-poverty campaign,
which some people feels sealed his fate.
A lot of people feel that.
Yeah.
There are
yeah.
a lot of scholars and a lot of people who have studied this feel that very strongly. But he had broadened his message and to talk about the war, to talk about economic justice. And squarely at the core of this is economic justice. It's, you know, people, the Associated Press just came out with this report last week indicating that there's really a credit scoring epidemic going on in the United States now, and 43 million Americans now have credit scores under 600, which basically shuts you out of the economy. You can't get.
But Chalo, I wonder, is this commonly known by, well, is it commonly known? I mean, I'm wondering whether listeners are aware of this. I have to tell you, I wasn't real aware of it. I hate to admit such ignorance. I wonder if this is something, I mean, is this something that people are actually confronted with and know and understand? Or is it just this below the radar?
I think it's below the radar because we have no-fault insurance in Michigan.
Right.
We've had it since 1973, and so you're compelled to buy it. And so you just buy it, and oftentimes we probably don't know as much about it as we should. But what happens is that they have passed these laws very often in the secrecy of the dead of night, with lobbyists right in the hallway that have gotten the folks to do what they want them to do. And in 1996, they passed a law saying that they can use your education, your occupation, as well as your credit score in determining your rate. Notwithstanding the fact that it has nothing to do with how you drive.
Sure. Now, and the Senate bill repeals this.
Well, the... we have a House bill called 5634, and it passed the House of Representatives in December, which says you can't do that. The Senate has yet to act on it.
Okay.
And in the meantime, the Supreme Court has sided with the insurance companies and said, you can go ahead and use those credit scores. So we need to trump the Supreme Court on this and allow the and basically get the Senate to do the right thing and to pass this House Bill 5634. That's what we're doing, this rally and town hall on at AJ's on Thursday at 5 o'clock. We're trying to bring Lansing to Ferndale.
There you go.
So, you know, we're going to combine it with a musical support for working families and workers. It kind of started out as an open mic. I'm a guitar player and singer-songwriter, and I perform at AJ's pretty regularly. And it started out kind of as a tribute to auto workers, and then a lot of them, you know, who have gotten laid off, they've seen their credit scores go from, you know, 700 to 500 overnight because they get behind on the bills, and, you know, being late on one bill can knock your score down 100 points.
Well,
so we're fighting back on this one, and we think that if the people make a big enough noise, the Senate can't ignore it.
Absolutely. Bush Hollow Out, thank you so much. So, again, that's this coming Thursday, 5 p.m. to at least 8 p.m. for the political end of it, the music. So, you're going to be playing on Thursday?
I am. I'm going to
play
you too. Yeah.
Well, okay. There's another another inducement for me to show up. And AJ's Coffee House Restaurant, great food, great coffee. It's in Ferndale on 9 Mile Road, just west of Woodward. And it gives more meaning, doesn't it, to the old expression, be there or be square, right?
Be there, be square.
All right, Butch, thank you so much. I'll see you Thursday.
Okay, thanks so much.
All right, bye-bye. And here's another case. You say, well, what can I do? I mean, maybe you're content to do nothing. And as I said, hope. You know, that's pretty audacious to hope, right? You just hope that things are going to work out for you. Maybe you're not going to lose your job. Maybe you're not going to have to take a pay cut. Maybe your pension is not going to disappear. Maybe these criminals aren't going to privatize Social Security or something like that. You can be active. And I don't know if I have used this phrase before. You can either become an object of history. In other words, the great forces and powerful men shape history, as we've been told. But we know so many times that people have intervened as the subject of history, have made history themselves, have taken it upon themselves to abolish slavery, to get women the vote, to end wars, to create unions, to bring civil rights to everyone, and to now to bring gay rights to so many people. And you can just kind of hang out and hope, or you can be active. Let's see. Here is Jeremy in Garden City. Jeremy, thanks for waiting so long. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Well, hey, Peter. I want to start by saying that I am a Republican, so this question I'm going to ask you may be a little slanted in that way.
Yeah, sure.
All right. In the start of the show, you mentioned the Bush reign and how he stole two elections.
Mm-hmm.
And while I won't argue with the 2000 election, I want to ask you a question about the 2004. Do you think the Democrats kind of shot themselves in the foot with John Kerry as a candidate?
Well, since I think that Kerry won the election, I guess they didn't. Kerry was a pretty weak candidate, and perhaps, I don't know who they could have put in at that time. But the election essentially was stolen in Ohio. That it was by these machines that were run by Republican firms, that one guy who, what was it, Diebold, who said, I'll do anything for the Republican Party. I mean, he was talking about something else, but he also happened to run the machines. And like Florida in 2000, the Secretary of State the state of Ohio was also in charge of the election, which, I mean, is such a blatant conflict of interest. And in fact, what you need to do, Jeremy, is just go online and Google Bush stole election. It's all there.
Well, the reason I wanted to ask this question, I was in the Army in Iraq in 2004, so I wasn't here for a lot of the political stuff at the time, but I knew the general feeling of military personnel to John Kerry.
Yeah.
I think when you multiply that by veterans and you multiply that by families and contractors, I would think that would be a pretty large group, and to put a man who demonized the military on, I think that was a...
Wait a minute. John Kerry is his war hero. He fought in the military. Bush, like the rest of these Republicans, are what they call chicken hawks. They're all for every war, but Bush scammed out of the Vietnam War by his dad getting him into the Texas National Air Guard, the Air National Guard, and jumping him over tons of other people, and the guy goes AWOL. The guy goes AWOL forever. Why in the world would this slacker be admired by people in active duty service when here was this other man that fought in an actual combat situation? And George Bush, he was just like a cowboy, you know, same thing. All hat, no cattle.
Right, and that's sort of my point. I think the Democrats had the right idea and the candidate they're looking for, but John Kerry and the Fulbright hearings pretty much demonized Vietnam veterans and the military in general, and a lot of military people do not like them because of that reason.
Well, I think you're really going more on myth and not so much in fact. He was always supported veterans. He's been a strong supporter of veterans and veterans' rights. I mean, the Republicans always are, you know, saying, you know, hooray for the military, support our boys, and then you can check the records of who votes for better benefits and all that. It sure ain't the Republicans. All right, Jeremy, think again about being a Republican. Thanks for joining us. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Here is Jeremy in Bay City. Jeremy, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good.
Hey, got two quick things to talk about. You're talking about these mosques and stuff that people are building or wanting to build in certain cities or whatever.
Yeah.
The only concern I have about it is the fact that if they're going through the proper channels to be U.S. citizens, and to pay their taxes and whatnot, then let them do it.
Well, they are, but, you know, it's a little hard. It's easy for people on this continent to come here illegally. It's kind of hard for people to come from the Middle East illegally, right?
Yeah. So there's, another thing that kind of plays into what I'm saying, though, is the gay rights, you know, for the marriage and stuff. As long as they're not pushing their beliefs or their lifestyles on other people, then I don't see why there should be a problem with it. I mean, I've known gay people in my lifetime that I've never had a problem with. I just don't agree with the ones that try to flaunt it and try to push it on everybody else.
Well, I mean, it's your right not to like it, but they have equal right. They can do whatever they want, can't they? I mean, they have freedom of speech.
I'm not saying that they can't. I'm just saying it's just not, you know, I think that's American people saying that's what's not okay.
I don't think the American people say that. We got to be careful when we talk for others. I don't know. You know, the times they really are a changing. To quote an old song, there's not. I don't know of too many people that are, as these right wingers say, promoting a gay agenda. But if people do, so what? They got the right to do it. People have the right to say they don't agree with it, and they have the right to say I religiously oppose it, and I morally or philosophically oppose it. But what? And I guess you're agreeing with this is they don't have the right to take their beliefs and make them law. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
You are listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
This is Matt Demmer from Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury. I'm here to tell you that now it's more important than ever to buy an American-made vehicle. We at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury are still in the business of leasing and want to help you. Whether you're looking for the hot new Lincoln MKS, the sleek Lincoln MKZ, or the hottest crossover vehicle, the Lincoln MKX, Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. At our dealership, we believe in honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. We encourage you to check out our virtual showroom on our website, Demmer.com. You can check out our vehicle inventory, and you can bet that if we don't have the vehicle you're in the market for, we'll do our very best to get it for you. While you're online, we invite you to get a no-obligation internet price quote. Whether you come into our newly renovated dealership or visit us online, we at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury invite you to experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood in Dearborn. Give us a call today, 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com.
Feels like time's running out. Maxed out on your credit cards, collection calls are coming every day, and you're two payments behind on your mortgage. You need help. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. Call Credit Card Relief right now. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. Call 866-290-8282. That's 866-290-8282.
101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks. 101 The Riff.
Look at those numbers.
Woo! Look at those numbers! Yeah! Can you believe we get paid to do this? It's only Monday! It's only Monday!
Excited about what you do? Well, pass it on. As a junior achievement volunteer, you can bring your enthusiasm to the classroom and give a few kids a little something extra to get excited about, their future. Share a little something of yourself. Be a JA volunteer.
For information on how you can get involved, log on to ja.org.
Energy Hog the team. Infiltrate the house and waste some energy.
No problem. It's got leaky windows.
And no attic insulation.
Perfect. Now go wild and waste some wattage.
The Mitchell House, a house like many others, except this one's under attack by energy hogs. They show up anywhere energy is being wasted.
Talk to me, hogs.
Washer, it's not Energy Star rated.
Outstanding. What about the thermostat?
Not programmable.
Looks like we're living high on the hog.
Only one person has the power to get rid of energy hogs. You.
Hold on. Someone's home.
Andy's got energy-efficient light bulbs.
To find out how you can fight energy hogs, log on to energyhog.org. You'll find fun games and lots of tips on making your home more energy efficient.
Now he's installing Energy Star appliances.
Not Energy Star. That's it. Get out of there. I'll get you, energyhog.org.
Hey, wait for me.
Brought to you by the Alliance to Save Energy, the Department of Energy, and the Ad Council.
Hey, Dad.
What?
I can't get the ketchup bottle open.
Here, let me try. Yeah, stuck all right.
Anything?
Now watch. If you take your palm like this and smack it on the bottom right here, you can get it open pretty easily. Here you go.
Thanks.
You don't have to be a hero to be a hero. When you adopt a child from foster care, just being there makes all the difference. To find out how you can adopt, please visit our website at AdoptUSKids.org or call 1-888-200-4005. A public service announcement brought to you by Adopt US Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Jaleen.
And just me, all by myself, Jaleen, off this Sunday, taking in some music. At 1 a.m. Eastern Time, I'm going to be interviewing Norman Solomon. He's the president of the Institute for Public Accuracy, visited Afghanistan last year, and he's going to be talking about the impact of those WikiLeaks, you know, where somebody gave the website WikiLeaks 75,000 pages of U.S. battle documents. Also, Nathan Adelman, executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, says that the government has lost the war on drugs. Well, you know, it's lost it in terms of drugs are available everywhere, and it's provided hundreds and hundreds, I was going to say. I should say hundreds of thousands, except that even that won't do it. Has given millions of clients to the prison industrial complex. So I wonder what this new bill that Obama signed is going to do. President Obama signed legislation on Tuesday reducing sentencing disparities between those caught with crack and those arrested with powder cocaine. The legislation was a compromise reached by the Democrats and the Republicans. The Republicans, of course, wanted to keep the disparity in there. They agreed that the old law imposed unduly harsh sentences for crack violations, which especially affected minorities compared with powder cocaine violations. And now, instead of 100-to-1, because the deal was, with the old law, a person caught with 5 grams of crack received a mandatory 5 years in prison, while a person caught with powder cocaine had to have 500 grams to merit the same terms. The Republicans have brought it down to 18-to-1. Well, isn't that nice of them? Clients for the prison industrial complex, of course. Drug war ending, well, after we've spent $1 trillion, millions of people have had their records and their lives and their employment ruined and reputations besmirched because of this. Millions incarcerated. A murderous competition that's created and still going on in Mexico. Mexico actually talking about legalizing drugs, hoping they can stop the rampage that's going on. The fight between, you know, sellers. It's just good old capitalism, except they're not really constrained by law. And another thing, this is more conservative hypocrisy. They always say, we don't want big government. We don't want an intrusive government. And here, they support intrusive government in its most harshest form and something that goes to our private lives. We want to get addicted to something, it's our business, right? If we want to change our consciousness, that's our business, right? Ain't nobody's business if I do, as the old song from the 20s went. Of course, though, we can't allow people to do that. And so if you smoke flowers, you can wind up in jail, as millions have. And really, again, what it's all about. For, I mean, one thing, it's about moral hypocrisy, what they're best known for, the conservatives. And the other thing is, though, it's an economic thing. And, of course, they want to, what? They want to privatize everything, Social Security, but also prisons as well, so they can give it over to their buddies that own the prisons. Man, if we could get these people out of our lives. Also, talking about the economy, one of the things, you think some things are safe. I always think, you know, you think DJs, I mean, they can't outsource my job, can they? You know what? They could. And they're outsourcing lawyers. They're outsourcing the work. You think, man, here are the lawyers. These are the guys and the women that are going to make all the bread, all the, you know, the big incomes, no matter what happens here. But as it turns out, they are outsourcing law to India. Let's see. And a guy that was Assistant Attorney General for New York State, Christopher Wheeler, now spends his time in a sprawling, unfinished planned suburb of New Delhi. He's got this office, and he works at Pangea 3, a legal outsourcing firm. Mr. Wheeler manages a team of 110 Indian lawyers who do grunt work traditionally assigned to young lawyers in the United States at a fraction of the cost. So American legal firms are outsourcing the work that they used to pay the new lawyer in their firm. And what do you think? You think they're getting paid a lot? Well, they wouldn't be outsourcing if they had to pay them a lot. India's legal outsourcing industry has grown in recent years from an experimental endeavor to a small but mainstream part of the global business of law. Cash-conscious Wall Street banks. Now, why in the world would they be cash conscious? They now have billions again. They're paying their executives these huge bonuses. But the deal is that greed is pathological. It's a definition of the capitalist system. Pathological greed of consuming more in wealth than anyone could possibly have. So if they didn't do this at all, if they kept all the jobs here in the United States, and here we bailed these people out, and they're taking the jobs overseas. Can you believe this? So, there it says, cash-conscious Wall Street banks, mining giants. This is like Rio Tinto, who is this has criminal violations of the environment and of workers and all over the world. Insurance companies and industrial conglomerates are hiring lawyers in India for document review, due diligence, which is kind of the same thing. It's, you know, you investigate or audit potential investments, contract management, and more. To win new clients and take on more sophisticated work, legal outsourcing firms in India are actively recruiting experienced lawyers from the West. The number of outsourcing companies has mushroomed to more than 140 at the end of 2009. So, you going to law school? Well, this isn't due too much for your expectations. Expected to grow to $140 million this year, up 38% in 2008, and should surpass $1 billion by 2014. Ain't going to be going here either. This is not a blip. This is a big historical moment, says David B. Wilkins, director of Harvard Law School's program on the legal profession. There's an increasing pressure by clients to reduce cost and increase efficiency. Forget about the increased efficiency. That's BS. It's all about reduce costs. They want to reduce cost, and you are the cost. You. Who's ever working is the cost. They can't reduce the cost of anything else. Remember we've talked about this? There's fixed capital. That's the building. That's the equipment. That's software, hardware, all of that. They can't get that any cheaper. But the only thing they can get cheaper is labor. The only thing they can get cheaper is labor. So when we paid our, let me put it another way, when we worked out a deal as Americans and many people in the West to work at a increased rate of remuneration, of getting more money for our labor, for our lives, of fighting to end 14-hour days, no weekends, no benefits, no health or safety benefits, nothing. Now they're going back the other way. They want to go where the 19th century prevails. This is the capitalists. The capitalists in the 19th century and into the 20th century, they murdered people, literally. Hundreds and hundreds of people that wanted a decent life, that wanted to be have a decent working class life, or even worse, enter the middle class. How dare these upstarts? And so they hired goons, they hired cops, they hired state police, they hired the National Guard to shoot down American workers wherever they had the temerity to ask for union representation. So now they're going where that's not a factor, where people are willing to work at those 19th century rates, where they actually don't have a bit of you know, choice in the matter whatsoever. And when they start to ask for a little too much in China, well, they'll go to Bangladesh. Remember that? We were reading that last week. People are getting upset in the ruling classes because people are actually trying to get a little bit more for the horrible labor they have to perform in factories in China and a lot of other places. So they're going to go, hey, we're going to go to the next place where we can pay somebody $64 a month. All right, let's go to Doug. Doug is in Utah. Doug, how you doing?
Hi, yes, I'm here. I'm doing good. How are you?
Hi, what are you listening on?
Well, I'm actually driving through. I'm a truck driver. I'm going through Ohio right now.
Oh, you're listening on the radio.
Yeah, I was listening on the radio, but talk about a breath of fresh air if this is. I drive all 48, and very seldom do I ever hear a station that, you know, has got a Democratic point of view that is fair to both parties. And, you know, in the sense that, you know, the other side is never fair towards the Democrats.
Well, Doug, in fairness, I'm not very fair to Republicans, but go ahead.
Well, if you could hear some of the stuff I hear on the radio going through different areas, you would understand what I say. But
okay.
You know, you bring up an interesting point about this outsourcing just now. I was going to talk a little bit about the gay rights, but I'll tell you a quick story about a friend of mine that's got 14 McDonald's stores in the Albuquerque area.
Okay, go ahead.
And he outsourced his drive-up window.
How do you do that?
They literally, when they go up and they push the button to place the order, it's immediately sent through a computer system to a group in India.
Oh, man.
And so they take the order at the order button. By the time you get up to the cashier window, you're talking to a real person there. But he went from he got rid of 27 kids in his 14 stores that he was paying minimum wage to, and he pays 12 cents an hour for the people that he outsourced to.
Wow.
And it, to be honest with you, it kind of ticks me off, and he knows it makes me angry when he talks about how much more money he's making because he outsourced these kids.
Sure, sure.
You know? And what a pathetic way to run a business in this country.
Well, you know, you could say, well, you're a truck-driving man, Doug, and they can't outsource your work, or can they?
Well, I'll tell you what, there's a new law that they're trying to implement right now called CSA 2010 that is going to really crack down hard on drivers, which some drivers do need to be cracked down on as far as tickets and compliance laws, you know, log violations, safety violations, you know, mechanical violations with your truck. And as soon as they can get all 48 states on the same system so that they can share data. They're going to implement this, and it's going, they're actually talking about getting Mexican, Hispanic people and Canadian drivers involved so that they have a bigger pool to draw from as they weed out the worst drivers.
Well, you know, that's interesting, Doug. That's what I was going to say. They can't outsource the actual driving. But if you start if you enlarge the pool, particularly when you're going to have unemployment as a permanent and mass phenomena, then you can start driving down wages. You can take the wage structure that the Teamsters created over the years, whether you're a union driver or not, and all of a sudden you're going to find people are driving for $8.75 an hour. And pretty soon, if you have the Republicans, they would abolish the minimum wage law altogether.
Oh, I can tell you right now, there are a lot of drivers that are out on the road right now just based on expenses and what it takes to go from point A to point B that are working for real low wages.
Yeah.
Some of these companies that have these come and drive for us, you know, schools will train you, will put you in a truck, and you'll have your own business.
Sure.
You know, some of those people, they don't make more than $200 or $300 a week.
Wow.
A week. They live out on the road working the long hours that they work, and that's what they make. And that it's a fact of life. And it's a pool of people now that from every walk of life that are going into these different companies, and all the big companies do it. And they'll be honest with you, I think they prey on the weak, the people who are needy, that need some place to work, and they're getting a whole lot of miles out of people that thought they were going to get in it for a decent living.
Actually, Doug, I mean, they would put it that it's simply good business. And like, just like they would say, if we went to a vendor and they said, all right, here's, you know, we want to sell you 10 trucks, you know, a Peterbilt or, you know, some other brand, and we're going to charge you $50,000 for this one, or for the same one, and or $48,000 for the other. They're going to go for the one that's $48,000. And they say the same thing in labor, except that, and that's why labor had to be organized in order to literally artificially raise the selling price of labor. That's an important concept, that unions artificially raise the selling price of labor, and also the minimum wage law artificially raises that. Because if it wasn't for unions doing that, and if it wasn't for the federal minimum wage law, we'd all be working for $4 an hour, right?
Well, exactly. You know, my dad passed away a few years ago, but his name was John Lewis, middle name. So you know where that comes
from. Sure,
from
the old CIO, right?
Absolutely. And so I live in Utah. That's where my home's at. The little county that I'm from is the only Democratic county, registered Democratic county in the state of Utah.
That's great.
And it's also a little coal mining community, and so it's all union. You know, being independent, there's not really a union for independent truck drivers anymore like there could have been 15, 20 years ago.
Right.
They've weeded all that out just due to high fuel prices and competition for work, basically loads. So, you know, there's no unions left in the trucking
world. Well, we've got a hard road ahead of us. Like I say, either we got to take what we're given and hope that it's not so bad, or we've got to organize. All right, Doug, thanks for having joined us. Appreciate your call.
Okay, it's a good program.
All right, thank you so much. 313-298-WRIF. A lot of people have given up. You've got to have some patience, folks. You got to sit on hold for a little while and, you know, accept that it's going to be there for a while. So if you came through the line, you talked to Stephanie, 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Oh, yeah, it's time for this. Yeah. Well, it's not that bad. Out of the castles, into the ditch. They're not exactly going that far. In fact, should we salute our ultra-wealthy citizens, because they're going to give away half their fortune. At least 40 of them are. 36 billionaires. Wait a minute, what is that? 24, 36. Almost 40. Including well-known philanthropists like David Rockefeller and Mayor Michael R. Bloomberg of New York, and less familiar big donors like Lori I. Loki, founder of Business Wire, are promising at least half of their fortunes to charity. And this was something put together by Bill and Melinda Gates and Warren Buffett. They give a lot of money away. So, you know, you'd think, wow, man, maybe these guys are doing the right thing, finally. The program has predicted that it will draw $600 billion into philanthropy. Giving away, saving more. Oh, yeah, here, but you know what I say? They're cheapskates. What? I mean, if you're worth billions and billions of billions, you're worth $45 billion and you give away 22.5 billion, and you keep $22.5 billion for, what do you do with $22.5 billion? I mean, that's like the budget of a state or something like that. And just to give you an idea, you know, sometimes, you know, you people that that don't support your own interests but support those of the rich. It's their money. You know, why? Who gave you the right to take it away from them? Well, usually, why do you want any money? I mean, most of us want money so we don't have to live under constant anxiety about buying stuff for ourselves or paying the rent or medical bills or stuff for our kids or, you know, anything like that. And you think, man, I'd like to have a big house in West Bloomfield. And, you know, I have one of them, instead of a Ford, I could drive a Jaguar and all, you know, stuff like that. Well, they've got all that 15 times over. They got, some of them got 20, literally 20 houses and all of that. And they still have billions and billions. So the money that they have isn't like you're taking away stuff. It's, you know, the wealth that could be redistributed downward rather than the way it is now, redistributed upward. So the rich are getting richer. But here, this is what Warren Buffett says. He's going to give away, wow, he's going to give away 99% of his wealth. He notes that the pledge will leave untouched his and his children's lifestyle. That's what I'm saying. You could take it away. You could say, we're going to make, and this is, I would support this, a law that confiscated all personal wealth, say, over $250 million. So guys like him would be left with $250 million. And this would be redistributed to where it's really needed. To our states, to our cities, to the individual. How about a big fund to forestall foreclosures and stuff like that? How about, you know, to pay people decent wages and all that? He says the pledge will leave untouched his and his children's lifestyle, and cites his luck in being born male, white, and in a market system that sometimes produces distorted results. I mean, Buffett knows this stuff. Like rewarding a great teacher with thank you notes. He gets billions, a teacher gets thank you notes. In short, fate's distribution of long straws is wildly capricious. The reaction of my family and me to our extraordinary good fortune is not guilt, but rather gratitude. Were we to use more than 1% of my claim checks on ourselves, neither our happiness nor our well-being would be enhanced. In other words, he has 99% more money than he needs, more wealth than he needs. In contrast, that remaining 99% can have a huge effect on the health and welfare of others. So, why don't they all do that? Why don't they all give it away? And the real question is, why has that much money been allowed to accrue to so few individuals and so many people and institutions that all of us depend on are hurting so badly? Confiscate the wealth, I say. Share the wealth. Redistribute it. Robin Hood economics. Here's Autumn in Windsor. Autumn, thanks for making our show international. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm actually from Buffalo, New York, though.
Okay.
The little brother of Detroit there. And sadly enough, it looks exactly the same. I was in Detroit about a month and a half ago, and I was like, oh, my gosh, it looks identical to Buffalo.
But there you go.
One of the problems we're having with outsourcing is Buffalo is the collections capital of the world. And basically anybody with any education level, whether they're a high school dropout up to a doctorate, can do collections and make the standard of living. And so now they're outsourcing them all to India, and myself, like, I hated working in collections, but I did for a long time because it was the only thing I could do that would keep me afloat, and I have 2 bachelor's degrees. Geico says I'm overqualified.
Wow.
and such like that. And then on top of it, the other thing that I was saying is a problem over in our area is they've raised the cigarette tax to like over $10 a pack now. And the come September, they're trying to make the Native Americans be taxed, which I think is going to cause more economical problems because the Native Americans rely on that cigarette income for financial support, and therefore they're going to then force be a lot of them having to apply for welfare that before didn't have to. And so therefore they're just going to have to shovel money in a different direction, so I don't think it's really going to help anything.
Well, on the other hand, Autumn, I mean, I couldn't care if they make cigarettes $15 a pack. I mean, come on. I mean, my father just died last year from lung cancer.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I mean, I'm a smoker, but I mean, I don't really have an issue with the fact that they want to raise the tax on it. I have an issue with the fact they want to tax the Native Americans, which is kind of like saying, let's tax the Canadians, you know, for buying, if we're in Canada buying cigarettes or something, you know. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, personally.
I mean, aren't the Mohawks, is the Mohawks there right on the border in New York and Canada? Is that the tribe? Or the Iroquois?
We have the Seneca.
Maybe it's the Seneca, but there's huge amounts of smuggling going on through the native land straddles both countries.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on. Unfortunately, though, in the Seneca Nation, especially in some of the Iroquois Nation, it's basically reliant on the income from the cigarettes. And so I keep wondering, well, if this actually goes through and if they actually follow through with it, which I don't think every store is going to actually follow through with it in 100%. But if they do, these places are going to go belly up, and then there's going to be a ton of people without jobs that are going to have to apply for welfare anyhow, so I don't see where it's necessarily. I think it's just going to get more money from one thing to get let it.
Now that's awful. If we were thinking, here are two choices: sell cigarettes or go on welfare. I mean, something is drastically wrong here.
Well, unfortunately, that's just how the Native American population right now is relying on either that or the casinos, and they got a little discount on gas. But I mean, really, the biggest discount you get about is 10-cent discount on gas, and Buffalo's got the highest gas prices in the nation usually. So
really,
it's usually one of the highest or the highest. It kind of fluctuates, but pretty high. Buffalo, Niagara Falls, we all have the high gas price. But the hugest problem we have right now is they're outsourcing all the collections jobs to India, which, I mean, nobody wants to pay their bill that's being called for a collections debt usually anyhow. But are you really going to want to pay somebody from India who you can't even understand half of what they're saying? I mean, really?
That's weird. All right, Autumn, I hope things get... Well, I don't... Wait. I just said the word I always oppose, hope. We got to make things better. But thank you, Autumn. I appreciate your call. Here is Andrew in Shelby Township. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Good.
Good. Listen to your show pretty regularly, and I think you brought up an interesting point today. You were talking earlier about legalization or the government control of illicit substances, and I guess I just need you to clarify, or would like you to clarify, what are you just strictly talking about marijuana, or are you talking about all drugs?
I don't think there's any, well, you know, there are limits on all sorts of pharmaceuticals, right? I don't know. I mean, I guess when it comes down to it, I have a pretty libertarian view. If unless it could be shown, I don't know. I should have thought this through, right? Okay, for sake of argument, I'll say legalization of all drugs, okay?
Okay, well, I mean, so you would support the legalization of, like, heroin,
crack, everything,
okay.
Yeah.
Everything.
Cocaine.
Are you familiar at all with the things that happen to people who get, you know, who overdose from heroin, or who, you know, the long-term effects that are
people survive quite well with heroin addiction as long as they don't have a constant supply. You know, heroin used to be available to people quite legally up until what, about 1918 or something like that. They used to put heroin in all sorts of remedies.
Sure, I guess maybe my viewpoint's a little bit different, you know, seeing the other side of things and, you know, overdoses and bad batches of heroin and crack, and what that can do to people.
Well, yeah, it's bad. I mean, people ought to be informed. I mean, I don't think there's anybody that begins an addiction that hasn't had information in advance that this is not a very good thing to do. And that particularly, whereas marijuana has generally a pretty good reputation, all so-called hard drugs have a bad reputation, right? And so there's some choice made there, and we should deal with that as perhaps a social problem, perhaps a medical problem, but certainly not as a legal problem. I mean, people that want to harm themselves by, or let me put it different, want to put themselves at risk by doing drugs that are generally considered to be dangerous, why in the world would we submit our country and other countries to what we see that has gone on over the last 75 years and goes on now writ large in Mexico, just to stop people from harming themselves? And everyone doesn't harm themselves. Pharmaceutical drugs, and even people that possess them legally, probably create more harm, more death, more, you know, injury than all the illegal drugs.
I don't know if I'd agree with that, but I think making the hard drugs or the more illicit drugs, you know, legal and making them available would only create more social problems.
But, well, you know, more,
and that's, you know, and you're a big proponent of, you know, of helping that, and I think it would create more. And it is, as far as cost, I think it would be a much more significant cost than you know, the methods that we deal with that now.
Well, that's impossible.
Law enforcement.
That's impossible because of all the law enforcement, judicial time, prison time, whole departments of the government and of every local police department with drug enforcement groups, raids on people's houses, little girls being shot, 25,000 deaths in Mexico. What could be worse than that? I mean, more people addicted to heroin? I mean, and if people want to addict themselves to heroin, that's their problem.
I understand that. I think the you know, the things that would happen if that were to, I mean, diseases that would spread, the, you know, the overdoses, like I said earlier, I don't think your thought is very well thought out. I think, you know, marijuana is a different story, but I think those more illicit, like crack cocaine, heroin, I think those are the types of things that, like I said, if they become legal, then it creates more problems than we have currently. And I don't know why or where your viewpoint, you know, I don't know why your viewpoint would support that.
Well,
that to me sounds, you know, like you're encouraging people to do illicit drugs. Now,
you know,
I understand that you encourage people to make their own decision, that you don't like government intrusion.
Right.
But I think this is a point where the government has to have some regulation.
Well, listen.
If there's no,
what do you think creates more harm to one's health and more social costs? By the way, when I said before, if someone gets addicted, it's their problem. I think that ought to be addressed by the community. All sort of problems like that ought to be alcoholism, cigarette addiction, what have you. But you may have seen this, Andrew, that Americans are continuing to get fatter and fatter, with obesity rates reaching 30% or more in 9 states, where there was only 3 states at that point in 2007. Obesity rates have doubled in adults and tripled in children in recent decades. The report estimates the medical costs of obesity to be as high as $147 billion a year. So what does that mean? We ought to send cops around to make sure you don't have seconds? I mean,
no.
Well, I mean, what do you think is going to be more of a health problem in, you know, would be heroin or cocaine use if it was legal, or what we're facing right now? Of course, if we legalized cocaine and people did it, they wouldn't eat as much, right?
I think that's kind of a ridiculous point, but, you know,
I meant it as such.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, the drug use, there's always the inherent risk of an immediate death.
That's right.
With heroin and with food, you know, unless you choke on it, I don't think there's that immediate risk.
Well, there's all sorts of risk, as you know, to obesity, and that's why they call it morbid obesity, because of the risks entailed. Look, I don't think people should get addicted to anything, whether it's television or cigarettes or anything, and that we have to learn to control our consumption, and it's something that Americans have a lot of trouble with. You know, I don't know how late you're going to stay up, Andrew, but Yeah, I'll play that first. I did an interview with a guy earlier from the drug policy. What's it? I can't remember the name, but something like that. Now, National Drug Alliance, I think it is. And he talks about those things. Hey, I got to go. Got to do these right now. But thank you. Other people like to comment on this. Hey, here's our number.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Did you know that life insurance rates are near record lows? If you don't have coverage, listen to this. AccuQuote can help save you up to 70% on a term life policy that's right for you. Pick up the phone and call AccuQuote at 800-654-2075. AccuQuote has helped hundreds of thousands of people save a fortune on their life insurance. Here's how. AccuQuote monitors hundreds of top-rated life insurance products so you can get the lowest rates. For example, a healthy 40-year-old can buy $500,000 of 10-year level term for less than $21 a month. Rates for women are even lower. A short 5-minute call is all it takes. Call AccuQuote for a free life insurance quote at 800-654-2075. Rates, policy forms, and availability vary by state. Find out how much you can save on life insurance. Call AccuQuote for your free quote. 800-654-2075. That's 800-654-2075. If you want a new computer but think you can't get credit, think again. Just call Tronix Country right now. No matter what your credit status is, now you can own a brand new desktop or laptop computer. Your approval is guaranteed as long as you have an active checking account and can afford small weekly payments. With Tronix Country, there's no credit check. You will not be turned down. Call right now and order your new computer. You'll also get a free color printer and a free digital camera. Just call 800-990-2258. But that's not all. Call right now and you'll also get a free 22-inch high-definition TV with your paid purchase. You heard right. A free TV with your new computer. All you need is an active checking account and your approval is guaranteed. Don't wait. Call Tronix Country right now. Call 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents lime scale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our final segment of the night. Some open lines at 313-298-9743. 1 a.m., I will play the interview I did with Ethan Nadelman. I guess I did it in December of 2009. It played on January 3rd of this year. He's the executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, says the government has lost the war on drugs, although, like I say, its main function hasn't been to suppress drugs because it hasn't done that. All of a sudden I can't think of the phrase, but it shifts our money. It's a wealth transfer, that is. It takes our tax money and then gives it to people involved in suppressing drugs and builds this institution called the prison industrial complex, and it needs clients, okay? Also, Norman Solomon, who visited Afghanistan, said essentially the war has been lost as well there. Talks about the WikiLeaks, the release of U.S. battle documents. That's at 1 a.m. All right, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Wayne in St. Clair Shores. Hi, Wayne, you're on the air.
Yes, Peter, how are you?
Good.
I got a comment about the gay marriage, and you're mentioning it. And my comment is that once you strike down traditional marriage, as you're saying, then it should be open up to everybody, not just to gays, because you know, kind of a Pandora's box there.
Who else would get married that's here to?
Well, whoever wants to. I mean, you know, if you want to marry your sister or your cousin, or if you want to marry three wives, or a lady wants to marry a couple guys, I mean, you shouldn't discriminate against those people because you're opening it up to anybody else.
You know, that's an interesting concept because there are some rules, right? I mean, just when you talk about legalization of drugs, that doesn't mean, what does it mean? Seven-year-olds ought to be able to get heroin. And those restrictions that are long-standing as well against polygamy or polyandry, which would be, you know, lots of husbands, doesn't fly. Well, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, we have not... that's not on the horizon. I mean, that's never been a big factor in our lives, going back into Western society. And all of a sudden, someone getting the idea that, hey, I can marry my sister because gays married. I don't know. I'll tell you, Wayne, I don't think that's a real strong argument. I have to say, it's about the only argument that I've heard. Even the people that supported the ban on gay marriage couldn't come up with anything.
Yeah.
You know,
I just don't think, you know, if, again, striking down traditional marriage, if you're going to open up to gays, you might as well just, you know, you can't discriminate against maybe people in Utah, you know, how they have that, you know, how they want to marry someone like that as well.
Well, I think they're, you know, when they start forcing 14-year-olds to have sex with, you know, older men and have virtually a harem, it's one thing. But I don't see anything wrong, to tell you the truth, with someone that wants to have... three husbands, or that's usually not the way it goes. That's what polyandry or polygamy, where a man can have four wives. I can't even imagine the situation. One, I don't know how you're situated, but I would say one is a handful.
I agree. But I appreciate that. You know, we agree to disagree, and basically we're.
Let me ask you something. If down the street in St. Clair Shores, where you live, there was a man living with four wives, would that concern you? Wouldn't concern me?
It would concern, because, you know, I don't know what if they have children. What does that do for the children? You know, all for society. You know, what kind of precedent are you setting? You know, I think the reason we have a traditional marriage is, you know, it's a betterment for society, and it, you know, and even gays have they're allowed to, we're not saying you can't live together or have the same rights. We're just saying, you know, for.
Well, you are saying.
Years,
yeah, but what about the idea that, whatever you think, and whatever that the validity of that argument, it's the Constitution says that you could not deny to any person within its jurisdiction, the United States, the equal protection of the law. And it's pretty obvious that that's a denial of that.
Well, I don't think we're denying equal protection of the law. I think, you know, they have a civil union that they can, which allows them the same, basically the same rights. It's just through all these years, you know, over. Since founding fathers, we have not, we've kept that same law. And again, not discriminate against gays or whoever, like you said, if they want to have certain rights in marriages, I guess, I don't think it's harming them.
All right. Well, let's leave it at that. I appreciate your comments. And, one thing, I just listening to Wayne, are there any gay people that listen to this show? Come on. I shouldn't. I'm carrying the water. Well, what do you say? He says you go beyond man and woman thing and anything is possible. And there was this nutball right-wing senator from Pennsylvania, Rick Santoro. He said next is going to be man on dog. And I thought to myself, if somebody told me I'm marrying a dog, I would say, well, okay. You know, I mean, you think this guy's too weird. But ain't none of my business. And he might be singing that old 20s song, Ain't Nobody's Business If I Do. So is everything permissible? Well, there's a harm factor. One of the reasons against, what do they call it when you're, boy, I can't even think of that word, when you can't marry within the family. Somebody help me out. Here's Jeanette in Rochester. Hi, it's Peter, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, good.
Let's let you know, yeah, I'm gay and I do listen to your show.
Oh, well, good, thank you.
I love a lot of points that you've made. The gentleman before was just stupid. In some states, it's still legal to marry. It's called incest.
Oh, and incest. Thank you. Yeah.
And in some states, they still believe in that, you know, whether it's right or wrong, which I think it is wrong because you're talking about genetic deformities.
Right.
As opposed to two gay people getting married, they can't even have children. So how can they project deformities onto somebody else or ruin somebody else's life? That's where incest would do that.
Well, I mean, he was saying that the gates are open. I mean, maybe you could say, making his argument, you could say, well, 12-year-old has the right to marry. I mean, we do have restrictions, right?
Absolutely. And the restrictions are in the benefit of the people. You know, it's just like when they said that blacks and whites couldn't marry, the separations, and then they take that away, and then it opened up the floodgates for everybody else. And I don't see how being gay and marrying a gay person, two lesbians marrying or two gay people marrying, ruins anybody else's marriage, because what I do in my home has nothing to do with what you do in your home.
Well, I don't know if you heard me earlier, Jeanette, but when they...
I did.
When the judge asked the advocate of the ban on gay marriage, he said to him, how does this hurt traditional marriage? And the guy said, I really can't define it. So,
the only way I could see it hurting the traditional marriage is it'll bring the divorce rate down. You know what I'm saying?
Well,
the divorce rate is way high between heterosexual people. What, are you afraid that gay people will bring the divorce rate down?
Well, somebody said... someone said that the people most supportive of gay marriage are the divorce attorneys, because they'll have this whole new category of clients.
And I don't believe that either, because right now, I mean, personally, I know a lot of people who have been with their partners for several years.
Sure.
I've been
Me too.
With my partner for 17 years.
Yeah. Would you get married if you had the opportunity?
Huh?
Would you get married if you had the opportunity?
Absolutely. In a heartbeat.
Sure.
You know, because right now, well, with her and my girlfriend's death, so I have a whole other perspective on it, because I can go in, if she has an operation or something, as her interpreter, but if something's to happen to me, they kick her out of the room.
Yeah, sure.
She's actually been escorted out by the police before.
Wow.
Out of a hospital, because they wouldn't let her sit there. But yet, if she was a male, then she could have sat there all night.
Right.
So how is that fair?
Well, it certainly isn't, and that is, as I read from the U.S. Constitution, it is not equal protection of the laws. And that's what the judge found, and hopefully, just like, say, the 1940s, seemed like a pretty dismal situation for African Americans, things changed in a decade. You know, I'll tell you, Jen, I'm getting a terrible echo, so I'm going to have to, I don't know what it is, I'm going to have to say goodbye.
Okay, I apologize.
It's not your fault, but it's just... Oh, okay. Thank you for listening. Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much. You have a great evening.
All right.
Thanks for your support.
Thank you. Sure. You have my support. Indeed. 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air, and I can't see a name up here, but you want to talk about drug policies in general. Go ahead. Are you? Oh, wait a minute. Sorry. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, who's this?
This is Tom.
Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about how you believe that all drugs should be legalized.
Well, do the opposite. Why don't you think they should? I mean, the drug.
Well, actually, I do believe marijuana should be legalized, because that, first of all, is safer than alcohol and tobacco, which kills
sure.
several thousand people every year, and marijuana has yet to kill a single person.
Well, the only heroin is bad on people's health only if you can't get a constant supply. I mean,
exactly, and the. And the black market doesn't allow for a consistent grade of product.
Right.
So
isn't that an argument to legalize heroin then?
I wouldn't say legalize it fully over the counter, but through a medical prescription if you already are addicted, like they do in Amsterdam.
Yeah, sure. All right.
So I believe, because in I believe in DC they're doing a needle exchange program, which is very necessary. It cuts down disease rates, cuts down HIV rates, because you don't want people shooting up with the same needles over and over again.
What about like ecstasy?
I actually had a buddy that did a little too much ecstasy, and it really messed with him. And I don't believe that should, unless you're getting real pure MDMA, like I'm talking like real like rave quality stuff. I don't believe you should be doing that.
Well, I don't either. I don't. You know what? I think people ought to be real careful and consider very strongly before they do any illegal chemical substance or anything that's been processed. I mean, the stuff can be dangerous. And the ecstasy that used to, I mean, the law against ecstasy actually created the problem. I mean, it was being used before the law, which I think it didn't come into the 1980s. People used it in raves. People used it in social psychologists used it and what have you. And it was very pure grade. Well, when you start turning it over to the bikers, they got one vat of LSD and they got another vat of ecstasy. You're going to start getting a, you know, not a consistent quality, as you say. So problem is, let me put it another way. I think the problem could be what we face in terms of, you know, health, public health policy is when it's illegal. And coming with it, of course, is the crime element and also the necessary corollary to the criminal element is the legal element. One can, well, one could exist without the other, but the legal element of drug suppression, drug use suppression, needs these criminals, because if they won the war on drugs, they'd all go out of business. There wouldn't be any room in the prison. There'd be too much room in the prison. All the drug enforcement people would go out of business, and they want to make sure that does not happen. That's for sure. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here's Glenn in Waterford. Hi, Glenn. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter Wirby.
Hey, man.
I've been listening to you for a long time. I don't know, 15. I'm 40 now.
Wow.
And I've been so I used to be a Democrat, and I've turned into a Republican. But anyways, hey, I'm all for the gays getting married. If they want to get married, have at it.
Well, that's good. That's good. I mean, there's so many gay Republicans. Aren't most Republican legislators gay anyways?
Yeah, who knows? I think our legislators are mixed up. They don't know which way to go.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure about them adopting kids, but you know, marriage is hard whether you're gay, straight, whatever. But yeah, I saw a
Wait a minute, Glenn. Did you just flush the toilet?
No, on my car.
Okay. I heard some weird noise.
No, I would not do that. Not to your show. I listen to you. How long have you been on the radio? I've listened to you forever.
That's how long I've been on the radio.
I love it. Yeah. I always catch you at night when I'm coming up for it. Anyways, I saw a study on a little Yahoo thing there, and they were going over all the different, you know, likelihoods. If you were, you know, if you've been married before and have children, you're more likely to get divorced by, you know, this margin. And they went through this whole list, and the most likely couple to have the highest rate of divorce, I'm not kidding, was lesbians. It's like 160 times more likely to get divorced than any other group.
We just had a lesbian on who said that wasn't the case.
It was just a survey. I thought that was kind of interesting. I showed my wife because I've been trying to explain to her that it's, you know, not all my fault.
I'd like to see a little more of that. But hey, thanks Glenn for listening for so long. I appreciate it. I only got time for one more. Actually, I got room for maybe one or two more. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Scott in Westland. Scott, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Pete.
Hi.
Well, I just wanted to touch base with you about hydrogen-powered cars, which we've talked about a lot in the past, but I just couldn't resist, based on the recent conversation. Imagine, you know, pulling into your fast food drive-thru and you're talking on the intercom to some poor Hindu in India who doesn't eat meat because it's against their religion, and you're ordering a double cheeseburger.
There you go.
But okay, let's not go there. Just a couple of weeks ago, somebody called in, they were talking about, and they felt that the media had been repressing news about hydrogen cars. And I'm talking about fuel cell cars, but the fact is that if you have a car that runs on unleaded gasoline, it can easily be retrofitted to run on compressed gas, and then, yes, the door is open to everything like hydrogen or propane or natural gas, et cetera. Now, the thing is that I'm glad you mentioned Stan Ovshinsky, the head of Energy Conversion Devices, or ECD.
Right out there in Troy, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So this was on Scientific American Frontiers, a show on PBS, with Alan Alda, you know, from MASH, the actor.
Yeah.
He's the host, Scientific American Frontiers. So Alan Alda and Stan Ovshinsky actually went for a ride in a fairly recent gasoline-powered car that had been converted to run on hydrogen. I guess that's the main thing that, you know, you need to know about that, is that it's not so much that it's been repressed. There's a lot of excellent prototypes on that. And if you either go probably, yes, as you said, to Ovshinsky's website, or which would be Energy Conversion Devices. I've been to that website. A lot of good information. They might have something there about hydrogen-powered cars, or even PBS, the Scientific American Frontiers website. You might actually be able to download, you know, a little clip from the show about that. But yes.
Well, also, I remember I was mentioning that film, Who Killed the Electric Car, that has Stan and his late wife. It's interesting that she just passed away not too long after that film was completed. But they're both up there in years. What was the car? I can't remember. What was the GM car that was sold in California?
Oh, yeah. It was,
not the Volt, not something like that. But it had something that suggested electricity, and GM, they had leased them to people, and GM said, we want them all back, and people were saying, no, we don't want to give them back. They're so wonderful, and they said, either you got to bring them back, or we're bringing out the cops. And then they took them out where? They took them to Arizona and destroyed them all.
Well, the one thing I would say about that, I saw that movie. The thing is that the good news I would say about that is that the people who actually drove the cars were really pleased with them. They didn't say, like, oh, this is a piece of junk made in Detroit. And maybe they were prototypes, so, you know, the quality probably was pretty high. That actually, the good news was people really liked the cars. The other thing is that, remember, there's a lot of crossover between a so-called hybrid car or even a fuel cell-powered car, because basically, the only difference between an all-electric car and a fuel cell-powered car is you've added that extra power plant of the fuel cell. So, in a way, I didn't really see, that much of a disaster in what happened with, you know, that original prototype. And I can't remember the name of it either. But
well, we're going to have to leave it at that because I am out of time. Thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Thanks for having joined us. Oh, yeah, what is this here? Michael wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I haven't gotten to any of these. I'm really concerned about these new vaccines they're coming out with. Did you hear about them? They are a form of genetically modified herpes that goes into your brain and eats your brain cells. It's not a joke. There was an article about it in Wired magazine. Many children in the UK already have died from these new vaccines. Well, I don't think that we want to take those, do we? All right, thank you for listening. Thank you for calling. Jalene will be back next week. Stay tuned. Oh, yeah, let me just sort of pre-sell it, as we say in the biz. I'm going to open it up because we were talking about drug policy as well. It's Ethan Nadelman, Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. All this stuff is on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. It also has information about this incredibly important Detroit March. It's a march for jobs, justice, and peace. It begins with a Detroit march in, this is interesting, my website, with a Detroit march in Detroit. Interesting. Where's my webmaster? Saturday, August 28th, we're talking about rebuilding America, jobs, justice, and peace. What a concept. Peace out.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Feels like time's running out. Maxed out on your credit cards, collection calls are coming every day, and you're two payments behind on your mortgage. You need help. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. Call Credit Card Relief right now. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. Call 866-290-8282. That's 866-290-8282. 101 The Riff. Detroit's rock station. 101 WRIF.
The Riff.
Look at those numbers.
Woo! Look at those numbers! Yeah!
Can you believe we get paid to do this? It's only Monday. It's only Monday.
Excited about what you do? Well, pass it on. As a Junior Achievement volunteer, you can bring your enthusiasm to the classroom and give a few kids a little something extra to get excited about, their future. Share a little something of yourself. Be a JA volunteer.
For information on how you can get involved, log on to JA.org.
Want to fight childhood asthma? Then fight it with a scrub brush and a hot soapy towel. Even in the neatest and tidiest homes, if there's so much as a crumb to eat or a drop to drink, household pests like bugs and mice will do all that they can to get it. Creepy crawlies like bugs and mice are unpleasant enough as it is, but they're more than just a nuisance for kids with asthma because they can actually trigger an asthma attack. So, give them a whole lot of nothing. Sweep up crumbs, wipe down tables, scrub dishes before they pile up in the sink, and store leftovers in plastic bags or bowls. Don't leave them so much as one tidbit or nibble, and you can stop a childhood asthma attack before it starts. Discover other simple ways to prevent an asthma attack. Call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS or visit noattacks.org, because no child should feel like a fish out of water. A public service message brought to you by the U.S. EPA, the Ad Council, and this station.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. I can't begin to tell you how many times we've talked about drug reform. I'm talking about illegal substances, controlled substances, and what a disaster the so-called war on drugs has been. $1 trillion out of our pockets. John Sinclair from Detroit once said, all this money to stop people from smoking flowers. But we're at a critical point right now, and very frequently when I've had guests on this program about drug policy reform, it's been Ethan Nadelman. He's the executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance. You can go to drugpolicy.org. And I'm going to give you a little bit longer introduction because I want to ask him a first question. And Ethan Nadelman received a BA, a JD, and a PhD from Harvard. He also has a master's degree in international relations from the London School of Economics. He's written a number of books, a couple of which we've interviewed him about. In the past, he taught politics and public affairs at Princeton University for 7 years, and he founded the Linda Smith Center. It's a drug policy institute in 1994, and he had the philanthropic support of George Soros, the philanthropist. And eventually it merged with the Drug Policy Alliance, and it advocates for drug policy grounded in what they say, science, compassion, health, and human rights. Now, I always thought this was kind of quixotic, you know, Don Quixote, tilting at windmills. Sure, great numbers of us think that the drug policy that dominates our laws and feeds people into the penal system is nuts, but I figured this was hopeless. As long as any of us could remember, there was these insane laws and all these people incarcerated for wanting to change their consciousness, and I often wondered, Ethan Nadelman's at his office at the Drug Policy Alliance in New York City, wondering whether he's ever going to get on the air. So let me say hello to him right now. Ethan, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show, and I promise you I'm going to give you a lot of time to talk and not dominate it all. But the question I had for you, given your background, given this extensive educational background, what in the world ever made you think that we could come to where we are now at the end of 2009 and the beginning of 2010? Were you ever confident that we could make the reforms we already have?
Peter, well, thank you for having me on, and you're saying all the right things, but I guess I'd put it this way, speaking personally, which is that if you have a sort of optimistic view or try to maintain a basically optimistic view about the evolution of our society, about human civilization, what have you, you look at something like the drug war. You see how profoundly embedded it is in ignorance and fear and prejudice and profit. You see how much our drug policies are divorced from basic science, basic medical ethics, basic common sense, basic notions of fiscal responsibility. And you see, at some point, this can't continue. It's just, it doesn't make enough sense. And then on the sort of the core issue for me is it also involves a fundamental violation of people's basic freedom, basic human rights, basic sovereignty over their own mind and body. So when I look at this struggle I've been involved in for many years and assume I'm going to be involved in for the rest of my life, for me, the analogies are the movements on gay rights, the movements on civil rights, the movements on women's rights, even the movements to abolish slavery and the slave trade in the early 19th century. I mean, every one of these things started off with a few people being accused of just being quixotic, and things will never change, right? But they had a sense that they were right and that they were on the right side of history. And each of these were multi-generational efforts. Each of them confronted powerful vested interests that wanted to defend what they had and that played on people's fears about the women and children if we reform policies. And each of these ultimately essentially succeeded. That's what's going to happen with drug policy in America. It's a monstrosity today. It's beginning to change right now. It's not going to happen tomorrow. It's going to take years and years of hard work and pushing. But I do have a fundamental faith that we're going to come to our senses and figure out a much more sensible and responsible way of dealing with drugs in our society.
Well, one of the advertisements that appear on one of the stations that this interview is aired on, all of a sudden I push a button and I hear, grow your own marijuana. And I thought it was like a joke or something, but it was part of Michigan's new medical marijuana law that actually permits this under controlled circumstances. So we've come a long way quickly, wouldn't you say?
I would say we have. I mean, it's hard to say. Look, on the one hand, if you go back to 1996, already 13 years ago, you had almost two-thirds of Americans saying that marijuana should be legal for medicinal purposes. And it's taken 13 years for 13 states, of which Michigan is one, to actually get that far. Now, I think the momentum is building up. I mean, we've seen that the politicians tend to lag behind the public when it comes to embracing sensible reforms. We've seen in a place like Michigan or most other states that you can't get the change in the law, you need to resort to a ballot initiative process, and that going through the state legislature can take years and years and years, and sometimes that's the only choice. But definitely the momentum is picking up, and not just on the issue of making marijuana legal for medical purposes, where now 70% or more of all Americans support that. Now it's picking up with respect to the issue of ending marijuana prohibition entirely. And I'll tell you, that's, Peter, where I'm very encouraged. The Gallup polling organization, which has been polling this issue for decades, They came out with a poll in late October that just was the most stunning poll results I've ever seen in this field. They show that not only did support for making marijuana legal jump from about 23% in 1983 to about 44% today, but they showed that in just the last 4 years, it's jumped from about 36% to 44%. In just the last 4 years, it's jumped to over 50% now of Democrats, over 50% of people out west, over 50% of people under the age of 50, about 50% of all political independents now support making marijuana legal. So that's a jump in public support for ending at least marijuana prohibition that is unprecedented in modern history in the United States.
Well, I almost drew out my teeth when I was reading the Wall Street Journal the other day, and there was, I don't know whether it was an editorial or an op-ed piece, but in any event, here's a prestigious journal among those people that are the movers and shakers of this country, for better or for worse. We could talk about that in another show. And yet, here was the author writing that marijuana should be legalized.
Well, you know, it's interesting. That piece, actually, which showed up in the weekend edition of the Wall Street Journal, was written by one of the Wall Street Journal's reporters in Mexico City. And he and I spent a fair amount of time talking about it last week as he was writing about it. And what he was saying there was, it's not just in the U.S., it's now in Mexico, where, you know, Mexico, everybody sees in the newspapers all of this horrific drug-related violence. But what makes Mexico unusual is that many experts in the United States, including the head of the DEA and others, believe that half or more of all of the illegal drug money being earned by the Mexican gangsters is coming from the marijuana business. And that's a major reason why a year ago you had the Attorney General of Arizona, I mean, fairly conservative guy, law enforcement guy, saying we need a debate on legalizing marijuana because of the violence there. You had the city council of El Paso, Texas, sitting on the border, saying the same thing. Hell, you had Governor Schwarzenegger saying the same thing some months ago, both because of the state budget crisis and also because of the violence in Mexico. So I think what they're seeing is it's not just happening in the United States. You go north of the border, where you have a fairly reactionary government that's opposed to any sensible drug policy, but over 50% of Canadians saying make marijuana legal. In Mexico, public opinion's not quite there yet, but more and more smart people are saying one of the best ways to deal with Mexico's prohibition-related violence situation is to make marijuana legal. Mm-hmm. So it's not just the growth in the U.S. This is becoming increasingly an international movement.
Ethan Nadelman is my guest. He's the executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Again, you can go to drugpolicy.org. They're actually at a point where they're doing a lot of fundraising. So if you got a few bucks rattling around in your pocket and you want to do some social reform, and it is social reform, as Ethan was saying, hit their website. It's always a site for great information, but also this is an organization that needs to be funded as well. So give that some consideration. You know, what strikes me so much about you, Ethan, is that you could be doing this work as the head of any policy alliance. I mean, previously, the people that were in the forefront of marijuana legalization or drug reform were, let's be blunt, stoners. Gaia bless them. They wanted, as you said, the individual freedom to change their consciousness in a safe way that didn't endanger other people, like driving or what have you. But now we're at a situation where this is taken on something that confronts, for instance, the economics of this country, the national security. When you think about what's happening in Mexico and how that leeches over, so I think we are, and I think you've certainly been in the forefront of it in your organization in recasting what this is all about.
Well, I'll tell you, I think that's right. I mean, it's true that the stoners have always played a big role. And you go back to the 1970s when 11 states decriminalized marijuana, and the organization Normal played a very important role in all of that, and Keith Stropp was one of the leaders. But it's also been an issue which has appealed to people on both the left and the right. I mean, let's not forget, you know, you've had William Buckley and Milton Friedman, you know, two of the lions of the conservative movement advocating for this for decades. You've had George Shultz, the former, you know, secretary of everything and Republican administrations who's been on side on this issue. You've had the Republican governor of New Mexico, Gary Johnson, who I think there's a decent chance he's going to be running in the Republican primaries for president in 2012 and becoming a better Ron Paul than Ron Paul ever was. And at the same time, you had distinguished voices, you know, in the center or the left from the ACLU, the former mayor of Baltimore, people like that. So there's always been a serious intellectual argument for ending marijuana prohibition. But what's happened now is that, I mean, look, 100 million Americans, more, have now smoked a joint at least once. We've had three guys in a row in the White House who smoked marijuana. The first said he didn't inhale. The second one admitted until an old friend outed him. But the current occupant, when asked if he had inhaled, said, yeah, and wasn't that the point, and many times. So, I mean, there's a change happening with baby boomers entering power, with the older generation of people who did not know the difference between marijuana and heroin. That generation's more or less dying off. You know, the medical marijuana thing is real. A significant portion of Americans know somebody who they believe uses marijuana really for medical purposes, not just for recreational. And we have now decades of evidence that there's never been a marijuana overdose fatality, that although marijuana can be an addictive drug, it's less addictive than virtually all the other popular drugs. The consequences of addiction are not as severe, and the ability to put that addiction behind you is better than it is with other drugs. And I think a lot of people also just saying, give me a break already. I mean, when Michael Phelps, you know, that thing where he was got, sure, the cell phone camera smoking a joint, and at first they would go, oh, this is terrible, we have to be angry at him. And then like 2 days later, people start going, give me a break already. I mean, he's 23, he's just doing what half of all of the 23-year-olds in America are doing. This guy just won more records than anybody in history in the Olympics. He spent half his life underwater. I mean, give him a break already. And people started actually coming out and saying, wait, stop the nonsense already. Stop the, and people admitting and coming out saying, I've been smoking marijuana for years and I have a high functioning job. I have a family. I am law abiding in every respect but this. So people are getting to a point where they're saying, whether it's the state budget crisis, whether it's the violence in Mexico, whether it's basic freedom or being honest with our kids and ourselves, that this whole war on marijuana, this arresting 800,000 people a year, this spending $10 billion a year on an unenforceable prohibition has really got to end.
And this is still going on. I mean, there's still 800,000 people a year.
Yeah, I mean, every year the number of marijuana arrests has gone up. It just dropped a little bit last year. But basically, something like 40% of all drug arrests in America are for marijuana. Of those, overwhelmingly, over 90% are simply for possession, oftentimes of just a small amount or a joint.
Hmm.
You have millions of Americans with a criminal record now for marijuana. It can screw up their ability to get a job. It can screw up their ability to get a license. If you're a legal immigrant in the United States who's been here for years or decades, sometimes a single arrest for a marijuana possession gets you kicked out of the country and thrown back to someplace where you don't even speak the language anymore. You have people all around America who are being fired from their jobs, not because they're high in the workplace, not because they're not a good worker, but because they smoked a joint over the weekend. So that type of hypocrisy, that type of malevolence, I think people are just getting fed up with it.
Well, Ethan Nadelman, let's go through some of the consequences. If it's 800,000 a year, and I guess it's come down because I remember at one point it was a million, but let's leave it at the 800,000. In a decade, that's 8 million people that go through the legal system. They're arrested by police. They're taken in. They're, you know, all that. If you can expand how many jobs are connected to these arrests, when I used the phrase, I think I did at the beginning of the show, the prison industrial complex. You have 8 million clients for the judicial system and for everybody connected with it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the extent to which this is clogging up the system. I mean, a lot of police don't even believe in doing this sort of
thing. Let me interrupt you.
It's part of the job.
Let me interrupt you.
Yeah.
1 second. It clogs it up, but at every point that we're providing other people with jobs who have to arrest them, who have to process them, who have to guard them, who have to transport them. You know what I'm saying? It is part of the economy. The arrest and incarceration or judicial deal is part of the economic system to the tune of billions and billions.
No, that's right. I mean, people, if you want to talk about not just marijuana, Peter, but the whole drug war system, you're talking about a bill of $50 to $100 billion a year. You're talking about fueling a prison industrial complex, which has become a sort of monstrous entity in our society. I mean, I hope it doesn't take until January 2017 for President Obama to give a speech warning about the power of the prison industrial complex, like Eisenhower did in his farewell speech in 1953, warning about the power of the military industrial complex. You see prison guards unions and you see private prison builders who are just engorged with the profits and the money from this. You see district attorneys who have no shame in terms of who they're putting behind bars and in terms of demagoguing this issue. So there are good prosecutors, there are good people in law enforcement trying to do their best, but I think that this drug war, I mean, look, we want police, we want prosecutors to protect us from violent and other predatory criminals. We don't need them protecting us from the people who want to use marijuana or even the people who want to sell marijuana to other adults. We don't need that.
Well, here, I actually was always trying to think of arguments against this. One of the arguments I heard that was sort of interesting is I would classify myself as a social drinker. I rarely even have like two glasses of wine or two bottles of beer in an entire day. I actually don't even like the alcohol high. It makes me kind of a little dizzy. I don't. But you don't social. There's no social aspect. I mean, it's very social. But I mean, when you smoke marijuana, particularly the strains that have been developed over the last 30 or 40 years, I mean, you're gone. So it doesn't have the same conviviality. I mean, anybody that smokes marijuana should not be driving at all, you know, whereas I can have one glass of wine and then drive home.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically right, Peter, although I think it's important to qualify that people who smoke marijuana with any kind of regularity become much more accustomed to the effects. And so, you know, many times people can be high, and you can't tell they're high any more than you could tell that they had a drink or two. So there are some people, you know, if you're smoking a new batch of marijuana and it's super potent or you smoke too much or you're a novice user, it's a real problem. And it's also true that you shouldn't get behind the wheel of a car when you're high on marijuana. On the other hand, hand, there's substantial evidence that driving under the influence of marijuana is not as dangerous as driving when you're drunk. And there are some studies showing that it's hard to tell an experienced marijuana user who's driving, having smoked a joint, from somebody who's not smoked marijuana or used alcohol at all. So don't use drugs and drive, but the science says that alcohol is dramatically more dangerous than marijuana for most people in most cases.
Yeah, and even with all of our education and pleas and what have you, they estimate that on a Saturday night there's easily 20 million people driving over the legal alcohol limit. So.
Yeah, no, that's a serious issue, and people should understand. I mean, right now, whether you make marijuana legal or not, it's always going to be illegal to drive under the influence of marijuana. I mean, quite frankly, though, you know, there are a lot of people are now, tens of millions of Americans are taking pharmaceutical drugs. We don't know how many accidents are caused by people being under one pharmaceutical drug or another, but oftentimes prescribed legally by their doctors. So I think when we're focusing on the roads, what we should be focusing on is developing tests that really test people for their ability, their driving ability, their reflexes, whether or not they're able to do it, no matter what drug they happen to have in their system, because people are going to vary dramatically in that respect. But, you know, Peter, the other thing I want to just say is that there are, you know, I mean, it's only in the last year that I've begun to speak openly about the fact that I'm an occasional marijuana user. I mean, I'm now 52 years old. I started smoking marijuana when I was 18. I've never used it daily. But, you know, it's something that I've enjoyed. And it's something that I've seen as a net benefit to my life. And it doesn't mean I don't know people who smoke too much of it or have a problem or are addicted to marijuana, because they're out there too. And I also know people who use it for medicinal purposes. But I am fundamentally similar to tens of millions of other Americans who use marijuana occasionally, who use it responsibly, who understand its relative risks, you know, and don't like being treated as a criminal.
Well, you know, the whole idea of addiction is usually what's behind the prohibition, that this is a health and mental health concern of the government. They don't want you getting strung out on these drugs. And yet the people that I know that are addicted, I don't know that it matters, but I usually say habituated. That is, that they smoke, that they, during their waking hours, they're usually high. And these are, that I've known in my, you know, life, police officers, assistant prosecutors, university professors. I mean, I could probably just go down the line of all the professions. I hope not my doctors or what have you, but you never can tell, because, and what sort of the standard line on this is that it's self-medication, that they're not going to take Paxil or something. Is that, yeah.
No, I mean, yeah. And Peter, I mean, that's right, actually. I mean, look, a lot of people, you don't want people getting high before they go to work, but there are some people who smoke a joint before they go to work, and they work perfectly fine. I mean, marijuana, like other drugs, varies in its impact on different human beings, and we need to focus on, like in the workplace, my bottom line, I have an organization of about 45 people working around the country. We don't drug test, of course, right? My bottom line is, are you doing your job? Are you doing the best possible job you can? And if you're not, why not? And if the reason you're not is because you have personal problems, you're going through marital issues, your kid's sick, you're using drugs at the wrong time and place, you're suffering from mental illness, I want to deal with that fact and make sure they're doing the right job. But I don't want to discriminate against one group of people because they happen to prefer using marijuana or some other drug over the weekend.
What if, you know, the idea, too, that if they made it available, that people wouldn't have to go to the extraordinary lengths that they do now? I mean, it's a weed. It's high priced. You can be one of the 800,000 people that get busted. And if suddenly you legalized it, that would increase usage tremendously.
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, I think that with respect to young people, that should not be a concern. There are now three surveys in recent years in which teenagers say it's easier to buy marijuana than it is to buy alcohol. So I don't think that marijuana legalization would result in higher levels of use among young people. I think, if anything, you'd lose the forbidden fruit syndrome, you'd lose some of the lack of control of the markets, and then I don't think we would see that group increase. I think for older people, people that are 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, what have you, you would see some increase in marijuana use among that group because they would have easier access. But for many of them, it might come, they might end up substituting it for alcohol, they might substitute it for pharmaceutical drugs. It might actually be a net benefit in their lives. I think that if we make marijuana legal, or I should say when we make marijuana legal, we'll see some increase in use, but I don't think we're creating any major public health problem. At the same time, to be earning $10 to $20 billion a year in tax revenue, to be saving $10 to $20 billion a year in law enforcement expenditures no longer having to be paid, to stop arresting 800,000 people a year, to stop giving people criminal records, to stop the hypocrisy and the lying dishonesty around young people in this issue, I think those would all be enormous, enormous benefits.
Ethan Nadelman, we just have about 2 minutes left with you, and I want to give you a chance at the end to just give another piece of information about the Drug Policy Alliance. But I think you hit on what I was going to ask. Are we talking here in terms of your organization, an advocacy of decriminalization, or in other words, just boom, it would be, I don't know, like I don't know what is in that category, or would it be something that would still be controlled in text?
Yeah, no, I mean, Peter, from my perspective, I mean, Drug Policy Alliance, we represent all the people who think the drug war is doing more harm than good. And that includes people who are sort of libertarians who want to legalize everything and minimize taxes and controls, to people who are coming from a more progressive public health background who want to end the prohibition but tax and control and regulate and treat this more as a health issue. And so we're in that sort of that spectrum of public opinion. I and my organization have played a pivotal role in legalizing medical marijuana in most of the states where it's now legal for that. We are increasingly engaged right now in trying to end the marijuana prohibition in various states with the ultimate objective of going towards national prohibition, repealing national prohibition of marijuana. But I just want to say, since you guys are based in Michigan, there's some great people in Michigan working on this stuff. I mean, there's a local activist, Tim Beck, who's done great work there. The Medical Marijuana Initiative, they're one with flying colors. The local ACLU has been great. There's even been some people in law enforcement working in this, people in the state legislature. And, you know, now with Detroit's politics changing so fast and with the sense of crisis that you've been through kind of evolving into a spirit of pragmatism and let's see what works, I'd love to see the city council in Detroit and politicians there and hopefully statewide begin to at least surface this issue, begin to hold serious hearings about what ending marijuana prohibition could do for the city and for the state. I think that time is now. I mean, 2010 is going to become the year in which the country's conversation about ending marijuana prohibition gets real. It's not going to sweep the nation tomorrow. It's going to take years. But the real conversation, the serious conversation, begins this coming year.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the facets that is so fascinating about what's happening in Detroit, there's a huge growth in what's called urban agriculture. Detroit used to have 2 million people. We'll probably have under 800,000. So that means there's hundreds and hundreds of fertile acres. I want to thank you so much, Ethan Nadelman, for being on my program. Ethan is the executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance. You can go to drugpolicy.org. In fact, I would urge you to do so, because this affects all of us in so many different ways. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Do you owe back taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? Or are you stuck in a tax payment plan that's getting you nowhere? The IRS is now taking very aggressive actions, such as bank levies and wage garnishments. If you owe the IRS at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debt for less than you owe, remove penalties and interest, and protect you from bank levies and garnishments. As a hardworking American, you do have rights. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
Riff. 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
I know, being a college freshman is supposed to be tough, but let me tell you about my schedule this semester. All 18 credits. Every Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I have American Lit at 8:05 a.m. And then I only have 15 minutes to get to my 9:15 Ethics and Value Theory class all the way across campus. Then in the afternoon, Calculus 1. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, I have two lectures that go through lunch. Sociology of Families, then Intro to Microbiology, pre-med. And finally, I have a double lab that ends around 9 p.m. Anyway, I just wanted to say thank you.
If a kid will do whatever it takes to get through college, what will you do to send her there? Please support the United Negro College Fund and call 1-800-332-UNCF, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. A public service brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
Hey, Dad.
What?
I can't get the ketchup bottle open.
Here, let me try. Yeah, stuck all right.
Anything?
Now watch. If you take your palm like this and smack it on the bottom right here, you can get it open pretty easily. Here you go.
Thanks.
You don't have to be a hero to be a hero. When you adopt a child from foster care, just being there makes all the difference. To find out how you can adopt, please visit our website at AdoptUSKids.org or call 1-888-200-4005. A public service announcement brought to you by Adopt US Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Mom?
Dad?
How long should I wait for you?
Mom?
If I'm at soccer practice.
What if something happens? Will you come get me?
There's no reason not to have a plan in case of an emergency.
Mom, if you're not home, should we go to the neighbor's house?
And some extremely good reasons why you should.
Can you tell me?
Everybody should have a plan. Take 5 minutes to talk about where you'll meet and how you'll get in touch with each other in an emergency. For other things you can do to be prepared, visit www.ready.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Energy hog the team! Get in that house and waste some energy!
No problem! It's got leaky windows and no attic insulation!
This house is under attack by energy hogs. They show up anywhere energy's wasted.
The washer, it's not Energy Star rated.
You have the power to get rid of energy hogs.
Someone's home!
And he's got energy efficient light bulbs!
Go to energyhog.org for fun games and lots of hog-busting tips.
Energyhog.org! That's it! Get out of there!
Wait for me!
Brought to you by the Alliance to Save Energy, the Department of Energy, and the Ad Council.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. This is something real contemporary, current that we're going to talk about now, but it's worth at least mentioning an echo of what we're going to talk about that happened more than a generation ago. And that was the release of the Pentagon Papers. You may remember that Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara in 67 commissioned this study, and it was released inappropriately in the sense that it was top secret by Daniel Ellsberg. And it was published in the New York Times. And the New York Times, in reviewing that act, said of the Pentagon Papers that they demonstrated, among other things, that the Lyndon Johnson administration had systematically lied not only to the public but also to Congress about a subject of transcendent national interest and significance. Well, now we have the website, LeakyWeeks, posting tens of thousands of classified intelligence documents relating to the Afghan war. They did that on Sunday, July 25th. They span the years 2004 to 2009, and these documents had been sent to the New York Times, the British Guardian, and also the German publication Der Spiegel, all of which produced these long pieces that gave interpretations of them. And certainly the kind of media splash that occurred in 1971 has not occurred now. Let's take a look at what the release by WikiLeaks of these Afghan documents mean. Joining me once again is Norman Solomon. Norman Solomon is the president of the Institute for Public Accuracy, and he's recently written a piece for CommonDreams.org, State of Denial After the Big Leak, Spinning for War. He's also the author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Let's welcome Norman Solomon in San Francisco. Welcome back to the broadcast. Hi, Norman.
Hi, Peter. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, a lot there in the introduction. Are these Afghan intelligence papers another Pentagon papers?
Well, I think they run parallel in the sense that they debunk a lot of the claims coming out of the Pentagon and the White House about a faraway war that supposedly was or is being won. And so in that sense, while it's much more raw data, this is not the cerebral analysis of what happened historically over a period of years. The Pentagon, in a sense, what really happened, the Pentagon Papers analyzing the contrast between what might have seemed to happen versus what actually happened. I think these WikiLeaks documents are much more raw data, out of the field reports, that sort of thing. And so, you know, it's every situation is different. Certainly these documents are different. And yet, as Daniel Ellsberg has said, who did leak the Pentagon Papers 4 decades ago, this is of tremendous significance, and he sees a lot of similarities. So I think the sum up, Peter, would be that while the nature of the documents is somewhat different, the political context has a lot of similarities. You know, I think it's fair to say that the Pentagon Papers conveyed to the public, wow, we were scammed. Mm-hmm. We were being told one thing publicly, while behind the scenes there was a whole other thing going down. And in fact, the same officials who said this war is really going well were saying privately this war is a disaster and were very pessimistic. And while it's not that dramatic a contrast with the WikiLeaks documents about Afghanistan, there's enough contrast there between the upbeat public positions coming out of Washington and the private downbeat realities of these granular reports to really have an effect of undermining to at least some degree the mythology about the supposedly positive events in Afghanistan.
Well, you mentioned, Norman Solomon, positive events. I was going to say that this time the critics of the war just aren't on the left, that everybody from the mainstream to the right, including the anti-war forces in this country, are saying that this war is a disaster, that it can't be won, that we're fighting shadowy enemies that may be, in fact, supported by our allies who are giving billions of dollars to, that some of the money that we send actually winds up in the hands of the Taliban, that the most unusual sources have called for disengagement in Afghanistan.
Yeah, including the a very conservative columnist, George Will, who, by raising fundamental questions or at least expressing his disagreement with the ongoing war in Afghanistan, proved that even a broken clock is correct once in a while. If you look at, I think, the contrast between the Vietnam War and Afghanistan War in the United States, the public discourse and debate, I feel like it's fairly accurate to say, and I'm old enough to have been a teenager during the escalation of the Vietnam War, that things were more polarized during the mid-late 1960s around the war. You had just had a lot of people who were passionately in favor of that war. You know, they tended to be on the political right wing, and there was a lot of fueling of that emotion from the Cold War and all the rest of it, and got to get the communists and that sort of thing. There still is a spectrum now where the polls ironically show us that the most loyal, quote-unquote, Democrats, so to speak, are actually Republicans. You know, the Republicans support the war in Afghanistan more than Democrats do, even though there's a Democrat in the White House. But still in all, I think it's less polarized. And as you're saying, Peter, there are quite a few people who would describe themselves as politically centrist or conservative who just don't feel very good about this war.
Now, and you have a situation that I think has been chronicled a lot, that people have pointed out, that the war is hardly on many people's radar screens. For one thing, during the Vietnam War era, the American casualties were 200-300, sometimes 400 battle deaths a year fighting the National Liberation Front, the Viet Cong, and the North with Vietnamese Army. Here you have a month and so a little, it's a little over 60. So people have made the point that there is no shared sacrifice, that it's being fought by a thin sliver of the American population. And although we all give lip service to the service of our boys and now our girls, it doesn't have great effect on any level to many of us.
Well, you know, when you look at the math for what that's worth, I mean, over a 10-year period of, you know, active U.S. military troop involvement, you had, you know, 58,000 Americans who died in Vietnam. So what is that, maybe average of 6,000 a year? Whereas now, as you're pointing out, the largest month, which we've just had, has been maybe 65 or so Americans. Still, for, of course, them and their loved ones, that's a huge number, because one is a huge number. At the same time, I think part of the reason, well, it's certainly that there's no draft here. There's an economic draft, but not a legal draft, conscription. During the Vietnam War, there was, and elites were able to get out of the war more. They had student deferments, but still, a lot of people couldn't get out of the war, including people who had some financial means and money. And so I think that's a factor, and also just the magnitude of the troops. It's 20% now. You know, at the peak you had 500,000 U.S. troops, a little more in Vietnam. Now it's 100,000. Still a lot, but not as much. And one more factor, this is much more of a contracted war. So you have a lot more private contractors, and they're not in uniform. And when they're making six figures, literally, sometimes $100,000, $150,000 a year, they're not as apt to complain, even if they come back without a limb or have PTSD. This war is being fought not only by uniformed soldiers, but also paid contractors who are not in uniform.
My guest is Norman Solomon. He's the president of the Institute for Public Accuracy, the author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. And you can go to Norman's website, normansolomon.com. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, .com. And we're talking about the release by WikiLeaks. There's a difference. WikiLeaks, about the tens of thousands of classified intelligence documents relating to the Afghan war a week ago or so. Tell us what you know about WikiLeaks. What is this all about? Suddenly this has just sort of popped up out of nowhere.
Yeah, it's been gradually surfacing. Julian Assange, I know as the Australian who has got a lot of technical expertise, and it turns out a lot of political and social commitment. I became, you know, vaguely aware of it in the last couple of years, but it was only a few months ago that it really got on my sort of mental radar, so to speak, when they released a video of an official U.S. Record of shooting from a helicopter of some civilians in Baghdad that occurred back in 2007, as I recall. And it was so dramatic. Assange at WikiLeaks headlined it collateral murder, which really brought me up short, because it said to me, you know, this isn't the usual sort of dispassionate, on the one hand, on the other hand, presentation that even on the web we so often get. It was a less controversial title, I think, after one actually watched the video that WikiLeaks shared. It was unauthorized. It was a secret video. And it was just devastating to watch. You know, it's what we might imagine, but to actually see it and hear it, these voices of these guys who are shooting and killing from the air as though they were in some sort of
video game.
I don't know. Yeah, a video game arcade. And to see it and hear it is just so nauseating and disgusting that I think collateral murder actually doesn't seem to be an overstatement. So anyway, that's...
Well, let me just interrupt one second here, because we live in a different era than the other wars have previously been fought. Even, you know, Vietnam was the first televised war, and the impact that that had on the American viewer in terms of giving them a sense of what war is really like. But all wars are are really terrible. And the home country always assigns the qualities of bravery and patriotism and sacrifice to its own troops. The other side is completely evil and awful and worthy only of destruction. But I don't think there's ever been a war where each side has not done despicable acts, killed civilians, shot unarmed prisoners, done anything you can imagine. The charges that we're eroding the confidence in our troops by sort of bringing out every bit of dirty laundry. Every bit of dirty laundry was there during World War II, for instance, and yet we're told that they are the greatest generation. I mean, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, you could make a strong point that by putting out this factual information, WikiLeaks is undermining U.S. support for the war because WikiLeaks is providing more information about the reality of war. And a lot of times people support a war out of ignorance or psychic numbing or being anesthetic or just buying the mythology. So if people want reality instead of the myth, then that's going to have an effect of undercutting this sort of blind enthusiasm for war.
Yeah, I would say so. Now, Secretary of Defense Gates said that it's not even a matter of rah-rah for our boys, but rather that the WikiLeaks leaks actually would endanger people in Afghanistan.
You know, there was Admiral Mullen, the head of the entire uniformed military of the United States government, who, if I'm remembering correctly, said that the head of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, has blood on his hands. That was the phrase coming out of the Pentagon. Peter, when I heard that, I thought, gee, isn't that what psychologists call projection?
Hmm. Yeah.
For the commander of the U.S. military that is taking thousands of lives, including American, but primarily Afghan lives, to say that the release and the releasers of factual information have blood on their hands is really to sort of throw into a distorted mirror what actually could be said about those who send us off. I think it was the songwriter and singer Phil Oakes who said, it's always the old who lead us to war. It's always the young who fall. And that, again, is a dynamic that does not change from war to war.
Norman Solomon, your latest book is War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Now, when WikiLeaks released this information to the New York Times, the British Guardian, and the German publication, Der Spiegel, they all approached it rather differently, and I believe actually that the New York Times consulted with the White House. Is this correct?
Well, they, as I understand it, showed or told the White House about what they had, you know, ostensibly to get comment, and they did redact, block out certain information that they thought might be hazardous to U.S. forces or troops.
And WikiLeaks did the same thing, right? They didn't release everything.
Yeah, WikiLeaks, in terms of magnitude of what they actually put out, there was a lot more of it, and they endeavored to redact, too. There have been some accusations and perhaps something to it that they weren't thorough enough, but still they went through and tried to take out stuff that they thought would cause any harm to particular individuals. I think the emphasis was somewhat different in that the New York Times talked about the difficulty of the U.S. troops on the ground in Afghanistan, highlighted some documents to that effect, talked about indications from documents that were released, these secret documents, that the ISI, the intelligence service of the Pakistani government, has been helping the Taliban, even though the Pakistani government is aligned with and getting huge aid from the U.S., whereas the Guardian newspaper tended to talk more about the civilian deaths and injuries as a result of U.S. military operations. And that's not surprising because, unfortunately, U.S. media, with some exceptions, really don't focus all that much on on what U.S. military operations do to civilians who are as innocent as you or I or people listening to this program in the Detroit area. So the reality is that we quite often don't get much discussion of the civilian deaths caused by the Pentagon in our names with our tax dollars, except when it's said to be injurious to the U.S. policy. I mean, I think, Peter, we can all remember some sort of media coverage, often quite frequent, saying, the U.S. killed these civilians. That's bad for U.S. policy because it discredits and undermines the government that the U.S. is aligned with, which is sort of a, frankly, bass-ackwards way to go about it. I mean, if we're going to say, gee, we don't want to kill civilians because it makes us look bad, that's not exactly the point. We should not want to kill civilians because we don't want to kill civilians.
Sure. Well, that the equation of who is killed in wars, soldiers to or combatants to civilians, has been reversed in the modern era. So now it's almost always the majority of people killed are civilians. Now, one of the things maybe we should address this, because as we said, there's so many people on the left, the right, and the center who think that this war in Afghanistan is going badly, that there's nothing that can be gained by continuing the U.S. presence there. It's draining our treasury, which cannot afford it. Another $38 billion into Afghanistan and Iraq wars, recently been approved by the House. And yet people would say, well, wait a minute. And this is what the Obama administration says. If we, quote, lose in Afghanistan, that's going to encourage terrorism. That we are fighting terrorism in Afghanistan, so we don't have to fight it in the U.S.
Yeah, that's an old story. During the Vietnam War, Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon as presidents said that the domino theory was real, that if the communists were stopped in South Vietnam, we'd have to stop them in Guam or Hawaii or whatever. And actually, in the 1980s, President Reagan said that it was necessary to fund guerrillas who really were, to my mind, terrorists, the Contras in Nicaragua, who killed into the thousands of civilians, because we were told otherwise we'd have to stop them at the border between Mexico and Texas. So this is, you know, an old technique, and we can see how true it was when Vietnam fell to the communists, all of Vietnam, and I haven't noticed a lot of communists in California here or anywhere, so it's sort of a mythology that's very useful. I'm glad, Peter, that you mentioned Treasury, because when you think about what is going on in the United States, the decimation of urban and rural areas, the lack of health care, housing, education, houses underwater, the foreclosures, the lack of jobs, we have unemployment officially right up around 10%. You know, it's all well and good for President Obama, who I supported for election 2008, by the way, to go to Detroit, as he did recently, and talk about how government subsidies and aid to the auto industry has preserved some jobs. That's all to the good, but when you see how many jobs have not been preserved and how the lack of money here at home is decimating our own society, you see the toll that it takes to spend these billions and billions of dollars on war every month when we have all these needs at home.
Well, Norman Solomon, we just have a few minutes remaining, and let's take a look at how all of this is being covered by the mainstream corporate press. I mean, I suspect you have seen this horrible-looking photograph on the cover of Time magazine, a young woman whose nose and ears have been cut off by the Taliban in punishment for some transgression that they thought that she had committed. And the idea is that, among other things, we have to stay in Afghanistan so these truly horrible people aren't able to bring back this repressive society of which they administer.
Yes, I went to a conference on Afghanistan a year ago with a Afghan-American psychologist who studied violence against women, and she actually showed on a slideshow, a PowerPoint, some very grisly photos, similar and actually worse than the current Time magazine cover. And this was domestic violence that had nothing to do with the Taliban. This was the reality that, especially with the war ratcheting up violence in the society, there's been a lot of violence against women, and cutting off their noses has been one of the most gruesome, horrible things done, not particularly by the Taliban, but in the culture, including in areas controlled by the Afghan and U.S. governments. So to sort of convey, or to try to convey, as Time Magazine did, that this was peculiar to the Taliban, I think is a real distortion and reminds me of a classic book by Philip Knightley called The First Casualty, from the phrase, you know, in war, then truth is the first casualty. And that book surveys now more than 100 years, really, going back to the late 19th century, of this kind of thing. I mean, this is boilerplate. This kind of Time Magazine propaganda has been going on for well over a century in terms of, you know, the Huns are the baby eaters, the incubators where babies were thrown from them when 20 years ago.
For by Saddam Hussein,
were ginning up support for what became the first Gulf War. So this is, you know, unfortunately a standard war propaganda technique.
On the other hand, Norman Solomon, neither you nor I would like to see a regime like the Taliban, so repressive, so religiously fundamental that that they shouldn't exist anywhere except maybe, I'm not even in their own homes. I don't even know where.
Well,
but what happens? I mean, that are we at a, and the we here, the pronoun that people use so loosely really is important here. Are we, and maybe Afghanistan, damned if we do and damned if we don't? Have we created a situation where there's no good alternatives?
No Taliban would exist without the U.S. The U.S. Funded, supported the Mujahideen to the tune of billions of dollars of aid, including weapons. And in with the Stinger missiles and all the rest of it came this misogynist, anti-women theology, not native to Afghanistan, imported from Saudi Arabia, aligned with the U.S., anti-Russian, get the Russians out. So the Mujahideen were fomented and incubated the hatred of women that the U.S. brought in. And the U.S. now claiming to be somehow the defenders of women, among other things, not only avoids the history, but the reality that women today have no chance as long as war is going on. When I was in Kabul, Afghanistan, a year ago, I asked women, what is your message to the United States? What do you need most of all? And the overwhelming answer I got was peace. You know, peace is a prerequisite. You know, we might think of it as a wispy word, but in fact, it is a lifeline that makes all other life possible, especially for women and children in Afghanistan.
Well, I want to thank you so much, as usual, Norman Solomon, for being on the broadcast. Norman Solomon is the president of the Institute for Public Accuracy. I get a lot, and I should thank you as well, not just for being on the program, but for the service that the Institute for Public Accuracy provides to talk show hosts like myself. You can go to accuracy.org, and you can see all the fine guests that are available, many of which I use. Norman is also the author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. You can go to his website, Norman Solomon, SOLOMON.com. There'll also be a link on my website to it all, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Norman, as usual, great to talk to you.
Hey, thanks, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Rip Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Feels like time's running out. Maxed out on your credit cards, collection calls are coming every day, and you're two payments behind on your mortgage. You need help. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. Call Credit Card Relief right now. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. Call 866-290-8282. That's 866-290-8282.
Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Line scale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove line scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents line scale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187. If you want a new computer but think you can't get credit, think again. Just call Tronics Country right now. No matter what your credit status is, now you can own a brand new desktop or laptop computer. Your approval is guaranteed as long as you have an active checking account and can afford small weekly payments. With Tronics Country, there's no credit check. You will not be turned down. Call right now and order your new computer. You'll also get a free color printer and a free digital camera. Just call 800-990-2258. But that's not all. Call right now and you'll also get a free 22-inch high-definition TV with your paid purchase. You heard right. A free TV with your new computer. All you need is an active checking account and your approval is guaranteed. Don't wait. Call Tronics Country right now. Call 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258.
Detroit's Rock Station. 101. The Riff. 101. WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Want to fight childhood asthma? Then fight it with a scrub brush and a hot soapy towel. Even in the neatest and tidiest homes, if there's so much as a crumb to eat or a drop to drink, household pests like bugs and mice will do all that they can to get it. Creepy crawlies like bugs and mice are unpleasant enough as it is, but they're more than just a nuisance for kids with asthma because they can actually trigger an asthma attack. So, give them a whole lot of nothing. Sweep up crumbs, wipe down tables, scrub dishes before they pile up in the sink, and store leftovers in plastic bags or bowls. Don't leave them so much as one tidbit or nibble, and you can stop a childhood asthma attack before it starts. Discover other simple ways to prevent an asthma attack. Call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS or visit noattacks.org, because no child should feel like a fish out of water. A public service message brought to you by the U.S. EPA, the Ad Council, and this station.
I will take it.
Everything that rocks.
It's ridiculous, but I love it.
101, The Riff.
Killing in the name of what they told you. Now you do 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 what they told you.
Some of those that work forces are the same that brought crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that brought crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that brought crosses. Do what they told you. Now you do what they told you. Now you do what they told you. Now you do what they told you.
HD1 Detroit. Everything that rocks.